so she saw that it was a special moment for me. And I went down the escalator and was waiting for my train when all of a sudden my son appeared next to me. And I asked, "What are you doing here?" He told me the attendant told him he should come down and give me an extra hug goodbye. He gave me one last hug and went back up, and I went along my way to the airport. What impressed me is that this woman was so perceptive that she could see just by our actions that it was a special moment, and she perceived, not only perceived and understood it, she had the compassion to take action and support me in my life. I am a widower and I live alone in Oklahoma, and my son lives in Wisconsin, so I don't get to see him that often. So that hug was a special hug, not just from my son, but also it represented the thoughtfulness, kindness, and care that this woman had for someone passing through the station.
Donald Kubara lives in Norman, Oklahoma, and you can find more stories of unsung heroes at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers. Online instruction available anytime, anywhere for students to catch up or get ahead in reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodBell.com/NPR.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.7 FM in Emporia, always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. It's turning into kind of a busy news day. I feel like I say that every day. Coming up in our next 30 minutes, we will have an update of news headlines. Then we will talk about the costs of evacuations as hurricanes have become more intense, evacuations become more important, and, as I mentioned, more expensive. We'll talk about a very small bright side of the Colorado River drought, and kids at a tribal school in Arizona are preparing for their own election to determine their favorite school lunch. Is it pizza or is it chicken nuggets? The eternal question. Kids are learning about democracy along the way. That story is still to come on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center at JCCC, presenting Hip-Rov, starring Colin Mochrie and Asad Mekki, November 3rd, combining hypnosis and improv for a totally unique live comedy experience. Details at jccc.edu/mtc.
Got a red flag warning. Very high fire danger till 8 o'clock tonight for Clay, Cloud, Dickinson, Geary, Morris, Ottawa, and Riley counties. Gusty winds up to 40 miles per hour. Also for Chase, Greenwood, Wilson, and Woodson counties. Gusty winds in that area up to 50 miles per hour. Wind advisory until 7 o'clock tonight for Anderson, Coffee, Lyon, Morris, Osage, and Waubonsie counties. And then tomorrow, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., wind advisory for practically the entire KPR listening area. Wind gusts up to 50 miles per hour tomorrow. It is 420.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations order food online from a nationwide network of restaurants, with tools designed to help save time and manage food spend all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As October comes to an end, many labor unions are blanketing swing states with canvassers going door to door. The AFL-CIO estimates that 1 in 5 voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania live in union households. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports from Philadelphia.
Skylar Goodman has been knocking doors in every corner of Philadelphia since July.
I was averaging like 5-7 miles a day.
Today, she's headed to Northeast Philly, not far from where she grew up. It's a working-class neighborhood of row homes.
The best thing in the world when you're canvassing, go right up and down the blocks.
Goodman works for the Painters Union. She's part of the AFL-CIO's mammoth effort to do labor-to-labor outreach.
People want to talk to somebody like them. And we do like the trade-to-trade, the women-to-women.
Canvassers like Goodman have been out reminding them that Kamala Harris has stood with striking workers and helped to create good union jobs in their city. They've tried to draw a contrast with Donald Trump, knowing the former president has substantial support among union workers, especially white men. They've highlighted things he said about how he hates paying overtime and about how he supports right-to-work laws, which allow workers to opt out of paying union dues. Goodman fears if elected, Trump would act on that.
Having a national right-to-work law would severely weaken unions' ability to organize and to do what we do for workers.
But the persuasion phase of this campaign is largely over. Now it's all about making sure people actually vote. Pennsylvania was decided by just 44,000 votes in 2016 and just over 80,000 in 2020. So even buttoning up a handful of votes matters. But even in blue Philadelphia, it's not the easiest thing. For one thing, a lot of people aren't home. There's only the Ring doorbell to speak to.
We can't answer the door right now, but if you'd like to leave a message, you can do it now.
Hi, how are you? My name's Skylar.
She leaves a door hanger that says, "Workers win with Harris walls." And then it's on to the next house.
We're going to cross the street here. Hi, how are you?
A few people who are home say, yeah, I'm voting, but they won't say who they're voting for. We find Vanita Bracey trimming a houseplant on her front porch.
It's personal. Like, I don't have to share that information.
Still, Skylar Goodman does what she can to connect with this voter. When she learns Bracey was a Head Start teacher, she shares some of her own story.
I'm a Head Start kid, so thank you for that. Yeah,
They chat for another 5-10 minutes, talking about early education and other things.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Did you want to hang on?
Sure.
Goodman leaves her with a list of union-endorsed candidates and feels pretty good about how Bracey will vote. But she says, you never know.
I'm home.
About an hour away in the Philly suburb of Norristown, Wernell Martinez is knocking doors for a different labor organization, the Hospitality Union Unite Here. Unlike Goodman, he's not from around here.
So I grew up in Puerto Rico, and then we moved to Orlando.
He was hired by Unite Here to knock doors in Pennsylvania, where his background helps him connect with voters like Josephine Villalongo.
¿Vas a votar por Kamala Harris?
Claro.
Yes.
He marks her down as a Harris voter and moves to the next question. How is she planning to vote?
Voy a votar en persona.
En persona?
She says in person, on election day. She points to her minivan.
Esa guagua va llena. Esta. Va llena para allá.
Okay.
A votar.
This van is full the people who go into voting.
Unfortunately, one person in her family who won't be able to vote is her 20-year-old son, Kenyo. Wernell Martinez discovered he wasn't registered to vote. But turns out the deadline to be eligible to vote in this election had just passed. A reminder of just how little time is left for both sides to make their final push in yet another close election. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Norristown, Pennsylvania.
In north central New Jersey, there's a special kind of sanctuary for turtles from all over the world. It's run by a man devoted to giving these animals a better life. Science reporter Ari Daniel went to see the effort up close.
Maurice Rodriguez has a sizable backyard, and it's filled with enclosures and tanks he's built that are just teeming with turtles.
Individuals, I'm at about the 200 mark. If I had room here, I would have thousands of turtles.
Rodriguez walks me over to an outdoor pen filled with shrubs and plants.
So we're going to start here.
I soon spot a dark shell splashed with bright yellow.
There's a box turtle in the corner here.
Yeah. I would put this species up against any other turtle species on the planet in terms of beauty. And that's what makes them valuable.
And by valuable, he means at risk of being poached. Inside this pen, there are 98 box turtles that were among those confiscated at the airport in Los Angeles last year.
They were headed out to the pet trade in Asia.
When Federal Fish and Wildlife found these turtles stuffed into multiple suitcases, each one had been duct taped shut and placed in a sock.
Smuggling trade is just a cruel thing for the animals. You know, with the stress, everything, it's just terrible.
This is where Rodriguez enters the picture. He's co-founder of the Turtle Conservancy, a group that cares for illegally trafficked turtles once they're apprehended. The team nurses them back to health with the hope of returning them to the wild.
That is the end game here.
An end game that, until recently, wasn't possible. But now, DNA technology has gotten good enough and cheap enough that Rodriguez and his colleagues can use the genetics of certain species to pinpoint an individual's rough origins.
So these turtles are wood turtles. They're in this temporary tub.
They've been matched to a population living in Pennsylvania.
And Pennsylvania agreed to take them back into the wild.
Rodriguez says sometimes the turtles come from a part of the world in turmoil or without sufficient law enforcement, so repatriation isn't feasible since they'll just be poached again. Rodriguez has a bunch of turtles from outside the U.S., including the Congo, China, Indonesia, and one of his favorites from Myanmar, a big green Burmese roofed turtle with a distinctive upturned nose.
The only turtle I really name, her name is Ruby, because Myanmar is known for its ruby trade. It's like the most precious, you know, gem that they have, and she's my most precious gem here at my house.
Rodriguez is a total turtle softie, something his partner, Fumiji Aoki, can attest to.
Feeding the sick turtles with the chopsticks and...
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. Do you know he hauls all the leaves from my neighborhood so that he can pile the leaves in the playpen, turtle pen.
So they have a nice warm blanket over them during the winter, and they love it.
For some turtle species, this exposure to the seasons is necessary for breeding.
That's important. If a turtle is becoming extinct or there's a problem in the habitat, you need to be able to set up an insurance colony.
Before I go, Rodriguez holds up a turtle from Australia, the size of a dinner plate.
Hold on, I want to show you something. If you take your finger, here, get your finger.
I gently push the side of the turtle's body.
She's full of eggs. You can feel the eggs.
Well, they feel kind of like a little sack of beans.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably going to be in the next few weeks she'll want to lay those eggs.
We admire her for a moment longer before Rodriguez lowers her back into the water. She slips away to continue creating a new batch of little turtles, babies that Rodriguez will shower with the affection that all the turtles here have come to flourish on. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
This is NPR News.
Supporters of Vice President Harris are aiming to win part of a Republican constituency, white evangelical voters.
To win some of these swing states, we don't have to win everybody. We just have to win enough to win this election and protect our Constitution.
The Evangelical Vote, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock, 5 to 9 a.m. Morning Edition. Your hosts will be Michelle Martin, Layla Fadel, and Jay Schaefer.
Support for KPR comes from Liberty Hall Video in downtown Lawrence with more than 11,000 titles on DVD and Blu-ray available to rent from classics to cult. Open daily from 1 to 9 p.m. A browsable inventory is online at libertyhall.net.
Stay with us. News headlines are coming up next. I'll start things off with a quick overview of our fire danger and wind advisories. The time is 4:30.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilsa Chang. A tribal school in Arizona is teaching its students about voting and democracy.
On the ballot, what kind of lunch they will serve in the cafeteria on Election Day.
I voted for chicken nuggets.
I voted for pizza.
That story after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The state of Virginia is asking the Supreme Court to pause a ruling that orders the state to restore some 1,600 registered voters that were recently purged from the voter rolls. NPR's Hansi Luong has more on the story.
This emergency request comes after a federal appeals panel called Virginia's arguments weak and, quote, not how courts interpret statutes. A judge ruled its voter removal program illegally purged registered voters from the state's rolls during the 90-day quiet period before a federal election when such programs are banned. An August executive order by Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin resulted in daily updates to voter rolls in order to remove people who are not able to verify they are U.S. citizens to Virginia's Department of Motor Vehicles. But the state could not show in court that any non-citizens were removed. Instead, U.S. citizens had their voter registration canceled. In Virginia, in-person registration for this election continues through Election Day. Hansi Luong, NPR News.
The Pentagon says North Korea has sent about 10,000 troops to Russia to train and fight against Ukraine in the next several weeks. That's more than three times the number originally estimated. Some of those soldiers are already on the ground moving closer to Ukraine. As Terry Schultz reports, the new level of collaboration with a third country with boots on the ground is causing a lot of concern.
It's something we've been hearing from the Ukrainian and South Korean governments for some time, but then the U.S. and NATO would just say they didn't have evidence of it. And then last week, Defense Secretary Austin did confirm the U.S. believes at least 3,000 North Korean soldiers are in Russia, and he called it a very serious escalation. A couple of other European governments have now said their own intelligence reflects this.
Terry Schultz reporting, the Pentagon is concerned that Russia intends to use the North Korean soldiers in combat or to support combat operations as Russia struggles to push back a Ukrainian incursion. You're listening to NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. We have a red flag warning, very high fire danger till 8 o'clock tonight for Clay, Cloud, Dickinson, Geary, Morris, Ottawa, and Riley counties. Gusty winds in those areas up to 40 miles per hour. Also for Chase, Greenwood, Wilson, and Woodson counties, gusty winds up to 50 miles an hour. In that area, very low relative humidity. Don't do any outdoor burning if you can possibly help it. Fires are going to be very difficult to control through 8 o'clock tonight for those counties. We have a wind advisory till 7 o'clock tonight for Anderson, Coffee, Lyon, Morris, Osage, and Wabunsee counties with winds up to 45 miles per hour. Then tomorrow we have a wind advisory from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. for virtually the entire KPR listening area, wind gusts up to 50 miles per hour at times tomorrow. Again, that's 9 to 8 p.m. tomorrow, a wind advisory for the KPR listening area. A survey released today by the Docking Institute at Fort Hays State University finds that support for Medicaid expansion remains high in Kansas. The annual Kansas Speaks survey found that 72% of Kansans support expanding Medicaid and 76% think doing so would help rural hospitals remain in business. That support is up slightly from last year. Democratic Governor Laura Kelly has tried for years to expand Medicaid, but the Republican supermajority in the Kansas legislature has blocked that policy. Alexandra Middlewood is a political science professor at Wichita State University. She says the response highlights how voters' beliefs on key policy issues don't always align with their voting behavior.
We can see that a huge portion of Kansans say that it is, you know, important to some degree, but there are so many other issues, too, that they're being forced to consider when making decisions about who to vote for.
The survey also found that significant majorities of Kansans support legalizing medical and recreational marijuana. An advisory group created by Kansas education leaders wants to reduce the amount of time students spend on screens. The group is recommending that teachers balance technology with non-digital learning experiences and that school districts not rely on social media to communicate with families. Kim Whitman is a parent in the Shawnee Mission School District. She says all personal devices should be limited, including headphones and earbuds.
Most of the devices would isolate them to where they're not interacting with their peers, which I think is a huge component of the school day.
The task force voted last week to recommend that all Kansas schools ban cell phones for students at every grade level. The Kansas State Board of Education will vote on the recommendations next month. It's 84 degrees in Lawrence, 85 in Topeka. It's 435.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Donald Trump made a campaign stop in New York yesterday at a rally in Madison Square Garden. What is making big headlines today are the racist and misogynist from speakers who came before him, the ones who were warming up the crowd for the former president. And a warning to listeners, the language here is offensive. For example, comedian Tony Hinchcliffe said there's, quote, a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. I think it is called Puerto Rico. Well, Hinchcliffe said that was a joke. It was part of a two-minute riff about Latinos and immigrants.
And these Latinos, they love making babies, too. Just know that. They do. They do.
It gets quite crude after that. In response, a representative of Trump's campaign said in a statement that, quote, this joke does not reflect the views of President Trump or the campaign. For his part, Hinchcliffe said he loves Puerto Rico and takes vacations there. Well, joining us to talk this through is journalist Julio Vaquero, host of Noticias Telemundo. Welcome.
Thank you.
What reaction are you hearing today to these comments?
Well, a lot. People really outraged, to be honest. Prominent Puerto Rican voices offering their public support for Vice President Kamala Harris in the hours after this Trump rally in New York, including Bad Bunny, the musician, Jennifer Lopez, Ricky Martin. All of them together have 300 million followers in social media, and all of them shared this video of Vice President Kamala Harris talking about her plans for Puerto Rico. And here in Telemundo,
just to clarify, you're talking about they were sharing the plan. Vice President Harris released her own plan for Puerto Rico, right?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Here in Telemundo, we've been trying to hear from voters themselves, from Puerto Rican voters. And in general, I can say there's outrage and they are disgusted. Some lawmakers, Puerto Rican lawmakers, Republicans in Florida, which is one of the states that have the largest population of Puerto Ricans. Maria Elvira Salazar, Carlos Jimenez, Senator Rick Scott, all of them expressing their outrage after this comment.
You're nodding to Puerto Ricans in Florida. There are millions of Puerto Ricans spread across the U.S., including important swing states, Pennsylvania, for example. How do comments like this make sense at a campaign rally for a candidate who is trying to pick up Latino votes, not scare them away?
Totally. And it actually happened the same day Kamala Harris was campaigning in Pennsylvania, talking with Puerto Rican voters. So there are around 500,000 Puerto Rican voters or Puerto Rican descendants who live in Pennsylvania, specifically in the Philadelphia area or the surroundings. And it can be very critical if you think about the margins and the small difference by which President Biden won the state in 2020, only a little bit more than 80,000 votes. So it doesn't really mean that all Puerto Ricans are going to vote against President Trump, but it is a reminder of how narrow the margins are, how they have been very narrow in recent elections, and the dangers of really outraging a big group of voters a week before voting ends.
How much weight, how much credence do you give to the comments from the Trump campaign saying, look, this was a joke, it doesn't reflect the views of former President Trump?
Well, yeah, I mean, they were quick to try and clean up what happened. The truth is that the whole rally had a very intense rhetoric, and we've heard this rhetoric across the whole campaign. Now, President Trump has been careful to, when he talks about migrants, to really say migrants and sometimes specify undocumented immigrants. Here, this comedian went like one step further, and he actually talked about people who were native-born and they can vote and they are Americans, right? So this is very delicate for the Trump campaign.
Mm. I mean, just to take a step back, I know you have been reporting on the Latino vote in swing states. How important is that vote likely to be in this 2024 election?
It's going to be crucial. Again, if we think about the margins, one in every four voters in Arizona, one in every four voters in Nevada are Latinos. And these are two very important swing states. Pennsylvania, same thing, around 600,000 Latino voters that can really make a difference when we think about the small margins that will give a victory to one or the other candidate. So we've been working on a podcast series and traveling around these swing states. We called it El Péndulo because there's no word to refer to a swing state in Spanish. So we think about this pendulum to make a comparison of how these states could go one way or the other. And we try to really meet Latinos where they are and understand what are the issues that they really care about and can really define their vote. We find a very diverse community, a very complex and dynamic community that's living in some of the most important states in this election cycle.
Julio Vaquero is host of Noticias Telemundo and of the special series El Péndulo from Radio Ambulante Studios and Noticias Telemundo. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Destructive hurricanes have affected millions of Americans this year and forced many to evacuate. Stephen Basaja of the Gulf States Newsroom reports that hurricane evacuations have only gotten more expensive.
Hurricane Francine was forecast to go straight through New Orleans in September. There wasn't any evacuation order for the city, but Nick Oquin was worried about power outages while caring for his newborn and decided not to stick around.
It is raining, and it's been raining since I left my house.
So Oquin and his family of four started driving to Alabama, and along the way picked up their first evacuation expense, snacks.
So far, the grapes at $3.99 a pound are pretty much a budget killer so far.
Add in gas, a hotel, and full meals, and Oquin estimates the trip would cost him somewhere between $500 and $2,000. That's roughly what evacuations cost these days, and it's way more than it used to be.
I'm not surprised to see there is a huge price hike on the evacuation expenses in the recent years.
Padla Mazumdar is an economist with Florida International University. He says evacuation costs today can be about five times higher compared to 20 years ago. And that's after adjusting for inflation. Mazumdar says that's because hurricanes are getting more complex.
For example, think about this Hurricane Milton. In less than 24 hours, it jumped from Category 1 to 5.
Besides being more destructive, these fast-growing storms can catch people off guard, leading to late evacuations, jammed-up roads, packed hotels, and higher prices. Of course, there are ways to keep costs down, like going to a county shelter or staying with family out of town. And when it comes to Hurricane Francine, Nick Oquin was lucky. The storm was weaker than Helene and Milton, and he ended up returning home after just 2 days.
Hey, Stephen. We're back home on the couch.
The final cost for his 48-hour evacuation, $505.
Not counting the school supplies that we bought while we were there.
Yeah, we can leave those out. You probably need to get those anyway.
Yes, yes.
By evacuation standards, pretty cheap. But he acknowledges that's far from cheap for everyone.
Evacuating is sort of a luxury, you know?
And with hurricane seasons continuing to intensify, that luxury may become more often a necessity, whether or not people can afford it. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Basaja in Birmingham, Alabama.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Colorado River drought has been so bad for so long that places that were underwater for decades are now out on dry land. And they're starting to grow plants again. Scientists researching the plants are finding thriving native ecosystems. Alex Hager with member station KUNC reports.
When you see a research paper, you see data and conclusions. What you don't see is this, the messy process of science in action.
I guess as an ecologist, I can't quite bring myself to just hack down vegetation.
In a narrow Red Rock Canyon in Utah, Seth Arns is gently pushing his way through towering, dense grasses, charting a path to his research site along the muddy canyon floor.
Oh, quicksand, quicksand. Oh.
What's the best way around?
You can go through it, but just quickly.
Arns is an environmental scientist, and getting to his research site requires about a mile of arduous trekking through the kind of desert heat that leaves you dizzy. It's in the triple digits under the southern Utah sun, but eventually the counting can begin.
12, 1, Baccharis salicifolia, 1,
Arns is producing the first ever serious data on what plants are living here. Tens of thousands of acres that are seeing the light of day after spending decades submerged under Lake Powell. In the mountains of silt left behind by the reservoir, it's mostly native plants taking root, the same kind that were last here in the 1970s, before the area was flooded.
And now not only is it not under the lake, but it turns out nature is doing a pretty good job by itself of coming back and establishing thriving ecosystems.
But it's unclear whether these new, thriving native plant communities might be drowned if Lake Powell's water level rises again. Its future is at a crossroads, as river managers debate new rules that will dictate how much water it should hold. The reservoir is unlikely to ever fill up completely again. Sarah Dant says that means now is a great time to study what the future might hold.
One of the things that is kind of astonishing about natural environments, almost regardless of where you are, is how quickly they can recover if they are able to.
Dant is a retired professor who studies the history of politics and the environment.
We have to be careful of our hubris in, you know, and I'm using air quotes here, managing nature, because you can cooperate with nature, but nature finds a way.
Zach Podmore, a journalist and the author of a book on Lake Powell's future, says nature is doing what humans couldn't, bringing back native plants in an area threatened by invasive species.
That's exactly what's happened in Glen Canyon over the last couple decades, but it's happened completely on its own.
And even though humans have spent millions on native plant programs around the region, we didn't need to intervene here.
The native species have been outcompeting the invasives in a really impressive way.
Podmore says, in a way, our struggles to manage a drying river are revealing an unexpected positive outcome of climate change.
Those trends usually go in one direction, right? The slow degradation of land. But what's happening in Glen Canyon is an ecological rebirth.
The next rules for managing the Colorado River are due in 2026, and they're expected to help write the next chapter for Lake Powell and the things that live in it. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Glen Canyon.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Morning Edition from NPR News brings you reporting from around the world.
NPR's Carrie Kahn is covering all this from the Venezuelan city of Caracas.
And we also realize there's plenty to learn at home, literally.
Here's my compost bin in the freezer. We've got us some tomato bits, and now we're adding 2 teabags.
Listen for the latest headlines plus useful life hacks every weekday on Morning Edition.
Tune in tomorrow, 5 to 9 a.m. Jay Schaefer will be your local host. Get caught up on all the national, international, and regional news first thing tomorrow morning.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Symphony presenting Putting on the Ritz with Rimsky-Korsakov's Procession of the Nobles and Grieg's Piano Concerto, performed by Chaeyoung Park on Saturday, September 2nd. Tickets at topekasymphony.org.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 99.5 FM in Manhattan, always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Coming up in our next half hour, former President Donald Trump's New York City rally yesterday included racist, sexist, and inflammatory remarks from various speakers. We're going to talk about that rhetoric and its potential impact coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, offering a local team to help businesses invest in the health of their employees with a choice of benefit options. Learn more at bcbsks.com/business.
Partly cloudy skies this evening, then clearing, breezy tonight, gusty winds up to 40 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and windy with highs in the lower 80s. It's 10 minutes before 5.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. As the swing state of Arizona prepares for a national election, the students of Salt River Elementary School have their own voting day. This year, the students at this tribal school had a big decision to make. Is their favorite school lunch pizza or chicken nuggets? It's part of a broader effort to teach kids about democracy and how their voice matters. NPR's Janaki Mehta was there as the students went to the polls.
Yeah. Hey, are we voting today?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Just east of Scottsdale, as excitement around Election Day kicked off at Salt River Elementary, I talked to a couple of kindergartners to get a taste of this school's favorite lunch. The polling was split.
I voted for chicken nuggets.
I voted for pizza.
This morning, Mrs. Meyer's class is getting geared up to cast their ballots. Pom-poms in hand, they're practicing how to spell the word vote with their bodies.
Show me an E, say E.
E.
What's the word?
Vote. I hear children coming up to me, oh, I saw the word vote in the car. Or I heard about voting on television. So
Dawn Burston-Myers teaches music and movement at this tribal school, and she loves getting her students excited about democracy.
And that's what it's all about. Starting at that young age for them to grow up to be lifelong voters and maybe president or councilman in their community to help their community.
Every year, students exercise their right to choose between things like jump rope versus basketball, PE versus math. It's through a nonprofit Mrs. Myers works with called Kids Voting Arizona. Her kindergartners sprawl out across the floor to fill out their practice ballots. The kids are on edge as they await the real vote from the entire student body later on. Whichever menu item wins will be served to the whole school on November 6th. As the clock strikes 11 a.m., students roll into the library. It's decorated with art of pizzas, nuggets, and American flags.
I'm going to give you a ballot, okay?
I can't believe this is happening.
The students get their ballots and walk over to privacy booths made out of cardboard. Then they drop their ballots in a box where Martin Javier places stickers on their shirts.
You know what that says? I voted today. Thank you.
Javier is the president of Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community. He knows just how hard it's been for Native Americans to exercise their right to vote. He reads out loud a banner in the schoolyard.
Your grandparents couldn't vote, but you can. And so that's kind of been the slogan here in the community.
Voter suppression tactics kept indigenous people in Arizona from voting until the 1970s. Javier and his team are working hard to get out the vote for next week's election, and these kids are a part of it.
Hopefully the kids are also going home and letting their parents know, hey, I voted today, and we would like you to go vote in not only our tribal elections, but the national elections, which is a very important election in Indian country.
It's a conversation sixth grader Alonzo Lopez has been having with his family.
I think it's really important because our ancestors weren't able to vote because the whites thought we weren't a part of them and that they were going to change us.
Once the ballots are in, tensions are high as the student council gathers to tally them.
41?
41.
And finally,
are we ready for the results of our election?
That's Principal Amanda Guerrero on the loudspeaker in the library.
The winner is pizza!
Yeah!
Yes, there were clearly cheers and some disappointment, but as the students of Salt River Elementary learned today, your candidate losing can be a part of the process.
Are you disappointed?
Chicken Nuggets was gonna win.
Was it still fun to get to vote and share your voice, though?
Yeah.
And anyway, what kid doesn't want pizza for lunch? From Salt River Elementary, I'm Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
Today, there is a big celebration in Mexico City, the Feast of St. Jude. He's the unofficial saint of the city, and the celebration mixes the holy and the profane. That's because over the years, the Catholic saint for impossible causes has also become the people's saint. NPR's Eder Peralta reports.
Late before San Judas Tadeo's feast, tens of thousands of Mexicans parade through his church. Most people here have asked him for a miracle, and they promise him something small in return, that they would come sing him Las Mañanitas on his feast day, that they would give strangers a piece of candy, or give away prayer cards or candles, or teeny bouquets of gardenias. And on this day, you see everyone at this church. Moms with babies, kids dressed as St. Jude, groups of young people smoking marijuana just outside the church. Susana Lara Crisoforo was standing right outside with her daughter holding a statue of St. Jude. She became a devotee after her uncle was cured from cancer. That was many years ago. She remembers when she arrived at the church, a man gave her a statue.
Yo creo que de tanta fe que tenía, mire, un señor llegó y me lo dio en mis brazos.
I had so much faith, she said. The statue just landed in my arms. There are many beliefs around St. Jude. One is that in order for a prayer to be effective, someone has to gift you a statue. This year, Crisoforo gifted her daughter a statue. It's why she's here on the eve of this feast.
Porque con ella sí tuvo un problema muy, muy feo.
She doesn't elaborate, but she says her daughter had turned to something very ugly. But St. Jude brought her back to the family.
Mire, que me dieron ganas de llorar. Pero sí, con la fe de Dios.
Faith in God, she says, can move mountains. Miriam Cruz Mejia is an anthropologist who studies popular religion. She says this devotion to St. Jude took off after a massive earthquake destroyed Mexico City in 1985. As Mejia describes it, Mexicans needed miracles, and they needed them fast.
Este sería como una religión rápida.
Mejia says the cult of St. Jude became a kind of fast food religion. It was accessible and non-judgmental. Over the years, he became the go-to saint for young people. Now, on YouTube, you find hip-hop songs about St. Jude. You find t-shirts that represent him in gold-encrusted urban garbs.
San Judas Tadeo es el que me hace el paro, dicen los jóvenes. Es el que está conmigo. Es mi banda.
In the words of young people, she says, St. Jude is my homie. He's the one who's with me, the one who spots me.
Y entonces el feligrés siempre dice, ah, no, pues es que San Judas Tadeo me salvó.
So the faithful say, St. Jude saved me from the cancer I had. He helped me stop drinking. He kept my wife from knowing I was cheating. These days, across the city, you find St. Jude in altars alongside the Holy Death, a folk saint representing death who is condemned by the Catholic Church.
Son santones, son
they are uber saints, she says, popular ideas that have been elevated to the altars, not by the church, but by the people. Back at the church, it feels like a big party. Fireworks explode in the sky. Street vendors sell St. Jude t-shirts, lucky bracelets, amulets. Father Jesus Garcia says he isn't surprised at the popularity of St. Jude.
San Juditas Tadeo, venga uno con la intención que venga.
The thing about St. Jude, he says, is that no matter what people's intentions are, he will always listen. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Carla Itzkovich, whose gift in memory of Moises Itzkovich, founder of the Moises Itzkovich Foundation, helps provide public radio news and information to communities around the world. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
We're in the final stretch of this historic election season. I'm Scott Detrow. Join us for live special coverage of Election Night 2024 from NPR News.
That's November 5th, starting at 7 p.m. on your KPR stations. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. 2 more hours of All Things Considered coming right up. Wind advisories in effect this evening and tomorrow. The time is 5 o'clock.
How the inflammatory rhetoric at former President Trump's Madison Square Garden rally underscored his anti-immigrant message.
For Monday, October 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Vending machines that dole out clean needles and Narcan become the latest tool to fight overdose deaths.
People who come to these machines have already made their decision, or they're already using drugs. So I don't see how it's encouraging.
Also, the number of black men enrolled at historically black colleges and universities is the lowest it's been since 1976.
And one man ate 1,200 tacos to pick the best taco in Texas.
There's no one style. There's almost endless possibility.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Just days after Israeli forces struck military targets in Iran, the U.S. said this should be the end of the direct military confrontation between the two. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Iran called for an emergency Security Council meeting on the issue.
Iran is trying to gaslight the world and play the victim, says U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield. She points out that Iran launched 180 ballistic missiles at Israel 4 weeks ago, and the Israeli strike Friday was, in her words, targeted and proportional.
Israel has made clear to the world that its response is now complete. And so we again call on Iran to stop its attacks against Israel and rein in its terrorist proxies.
Iran says it reserves the right to respond to what it calls criminal acts by Israel. Israel's ambassador says any further aggression will be met with swift and painful consequences. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Concern over election-related political violence remains high, but the threat has changed from what it was before the 2020 election, when organized extremist groups were much more active. Here's NPR's Odette Youssef.
Data show that extremist groups have mobilized far less in 2024 than they did in 2020. Data from ACLED, the Armed Conflict Location and Events Data Project, show the activity has fallen by half. But ACLED's Kieran Doyle says the potential for political violence is still high.
Violence by individuals has been a huge concern this year, obviously with the two assassination attempts against Trump.
The Department of Homeland Security has similarly warned about individuals and small cells. A recent intelligence memo from DHS also noted that domestic extremists may be using encrypted and private group communication platforms, making the planning for acts of violence harder to detect. Odette Youssef, NPR News.
More than 200,000 people have canceled subscriptions to The Washington Post in the wake of the decision by owner Jeff Bezos not to endorse either candidate in the race for the White House. NPR's David Folkenflik broke the story last week and has this update.
The fallout at the Post has been ferocious in the 3 days since the news of Bezos' decision broke. The editorial page has repeatedly cited former President Donald Trump as a threat to American democracy. Its editor approved plans to endorse Vice President Kamala Harris. He told colleagues that Bezos wasn't sold and that he failed to convince Bezos to change his mind. Two columnists resigned and two writers stepped down from the editorial page. Former Post executive editor Marty Baron tells NPR that Bezos' decision will encourage Trump to try to intimidate the press. And now cancellations are pouring in, even from the relatives of journalists at the Post itself. The company declined comment. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Stocks gained ground on Wall Street to start the trading week. The Dow was up 273 points. The Nasdaq closed up 48 points today. You're listening to NPR. Apple has been billing its new iPhone 16 as the first to incorporate artificial intelligence in its operating system. And today, Apple released a software update designed to make that more of a reality. The upgrade to the iOS 18 operating system came out today, more than a month after iPhone 16 models equipped with the latest technology to utilize AI went on the market. Among other things, the update's expected to make the company's virtual assistant Siri a more conversational and versatile companion.
Many species of turtles are poached globally, including from within the U.S. Science reporter Ari Daniel says that when confiscated here, authorities often call the Turtle Conservancy to take the animals.
In north central New Jersey, Maurice Rodriguez's backyard is teeming with a couple hundred turtles.
If I had room here, I would have thousands of turtles.
Rodriguez is co-founder of the Turtle Conservancy, a group that cares for the illegally trafficked species.
So these turtles are wood turtles. They're in this temporary tub.
DNA technology is now good enough that he and his colleagues can use the genetics of certain species to pinpoint an individual's rough origins. These wood turtles were matched to a population living in Pennsylvania.
And Pennsylvania agreed to take them back into the wild.
This return is Rodriguez's hope for what happens to as many of the turtles here as possible. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
Crude oil futures prices moved lower today. Oil down $4.40 a barrel to settle at $67.38 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Cromwell Environmental, serving Kansas and Missouri customers since 1982, offering testing and solutions for mold, lead, and asbestos problems. More information at cromwellenvironmental.com.
This is KPR. It's 5:06.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. On Sunday afternoon, to kick off the last full week of the 2024 presidential campaign, thousands of people lined up under a screen several stories high with the image of former President Donald Trump. They were waiting outside New York's Madison Square Garden, where Trump was holding a campaign rally. It was a homecoming of sorts for the man who's portrayed himself as the quintessential New Yorker.
I'm thrilled to be back in the city I love, and thousands of proud, hardworking American patriots, you're with me. We're all.
The headliner took the stage 2 hours after he was scheduled to. And before that, more than 24 others spoke. Many leaned into racist, misogynistic, and vulgar rhetoric, like comedian Tony Hinchcliffe.
I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah. I think it's called Puerto Rico.
There was intense backlash, and a Trump campaign advisor later put out a statement distancing the former president from Hinchcliffe's remarks. But Hinchcliffe wasn't the only speaker who used incendiary language during the rally Sunday night. Trump's childhood friend David Rem had this to say about Vice President Kamala Harris.
In fact, she is the devil, whoever screamed that out.
And Stephen Miller, a policy advisor in the Trump White House and current senior campaign advisor, underscored the former president's anti-immigrant message.
America is for Americans and Americans only.
Other speakers included Elon Musk, Hulk Hogan, New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, and Phil McGraw, better known as Dr. Phil. Finally, more than 4 hours into the program, Trump took the stage and spoke for another 78 minutes, repeating many of the themes his warm-up acts had touched on.
On day one, I will launch the largest deportation program in American history. Can we get the criminals? We will get critical race theory and transgender insanity the hell out of our school. Kamala Harris is a train wreck who has destroyed everything in her path to make her president would be a gamble with the lives of millions and millions of people.
Well, NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben was at that rally last night, and she's with us now. Hi, Danielle.
Hey, Ari.
That joke about Puerto Rico, where the comedian called it a floating island of garbage, is getting the most backlash today. What's the response been?
Well, the fallout was immediate. Before the rally was even over, you had New York Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Vice Presidential nominee Tim Walz, who were doing an online event for the Harris campaign already. They played that clip and reacted with disgust as they heard it. Not only that, but pretty immediately, the Harris campaign itself quickly retweeted a clip. But the backlash has not at all been only from Democrats. Republican politicians, including Florida Senator Rick Scott and Congressman Carlos Jimenez, posted on X last night also criticizing that joke. And the Trump campaign, as you mentioned, got the message. In a statement late last night, the campaign senior advisor Danielle Alvarez said, quote, "This joke does not reflect the views of President Trump or the campaign."
That one line has gotten the most attention, but the rally as a whole has received a lot of criticism. You were there for those many hours. What stood out to you about it?
Well, a lot stood out. I mean, several speakers, as you said again, made racist, misogynistic, and just inflammatory remarks, which might even be putting it mildly. I mean, Hinchcliffe made a joke about football player Travis Kelce killing his girlfriend, Taylor Swift. Investor Grant Cardone was particularly crude in talking about Harris.
She's a fake. I'm not here to invalidate her. She's a fake, a fraud. She's a pretender. Her and her pimp handlers will destroy our country.
And then conservative commentator Tucker Carlson insulted Kamala Harris's mixed race heritage as well as her intelligence. Here he was.
It's going to be pretty hard to look at us and say, you know what? Kamala Harris, she got 85 million votes because she's just so impressive. As the first Samoan Malaysian low IQ former California prosecutor ever to be elected president, it was just a groundswell of popular support.
And even beyond his insults, Carlson referenced the racist great replacement theory, saying in his speech that Democrats want to, quote, replace Americans with, as he put it, people who would be reliable voters.
You have covered Trump's campaign all year. Do you expect it to be affected by any of this?
You know, what's been remarkable in this absolutely wild election year is that almost nothing has shifted the polls, short of the Democrats swapping candidates. Besides that, it's been remarkably stable. Assassination attempts, Trump saying immigrants are vermin or poisoning the blood of the nation, Trump's generals calling him fascist. Nothing seems to budge anything. So in that light, I don't know if even this kind of a night is going to swing anything. But as we keep saying, this is a close race. It'll be decided in a handful of states. So it doesn't take that big of a swing to have a decisive impact. But one really remarkable thing is that the Trump campaign is very clearly taking the response to this rally seriously in that they responded and said they don't agree with that joke about Puerto Ricans.
And why is that significant?
Well, because the campaign rarely disavows support and they certainly don't backtrack on offensive rhetoric, at least very rarely do they. I mean, often when Trump's opponents criticize him, his supporters see that as a good thing. For example, ahead of last night's rally, opponents, including Hillary Clinton, compared this rally to a Nazi rally that was held at Madison Square Garden in 1939. So then last night, speakers joked about that. Here's Terry Bollea, who people might better know as Hulk Hogan.
I don't see no stinking Nazis in here. I don't see no stinking domestic terrorists in here.
I mean, think about all the things Trump doesn't back down from. A couple weeks ago, he called Democrats the enemy from within and suggested he'd use the military on them. And, well, last night, he doubled down on that once again, saying, yes, they are the enemy from within. So maybe in the next few days he could turn down the temperature, but also he has shown so clearly that that's not something he likes to do.
That's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, whether you like them folded in a corn or flour tortilla with green salsa or red, tacos are one of the most iconic foods in Texas. Jose Relat traveled all over the state, that's 14,000 miles, eating more than 1,200 tacos along the way to come up with Texas Monthly's new list, the 50 best tacos in Texas. Relat is Texas Monthly's taco editor, a dream job, am I right? And he's here to talk about how the state's iconic food is evolving in 2024. Welcome back to NPR.
Thank you.
So great to have you. And before we begin, you wanted me to note that you have a speech impediment, yeah?
Yes.
All right. Well, let's dig into your rankings here. Can you tell me about the taco that took first place?
Yeah. So, Analista Quería's Chile spray in a taco is deceptively simple looking. It's a corn tortilla with an opened green chili, cheese, and then fajita. But when you bite into it, everything comes together, from the fragrant, wonderfully chewy corn tortilla to the salty cheese, the spice of the chile and the smoky beef. It's just wild that something like that could even exist.
Oh my God.
And it's also fun.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be a little sense of fun in tacos, right?
Oh, absolutely. Tell me what was fun about this chile relleno taco.
Well, it's pretty looking. Uh-huh. It's creative in that it's deconstructed. And also to think that in flour-dominating South Texas, that there's this bastion of nixtamalized corn tortillas is wild. Now, for those who don't know, nixtamalization is basically the process that the Aztecs used to cook and soak corn in an alkaline solution that releases all the nutrients that are inside corn kernels, therefore making superfood.
So cool. Well, you wrote that throughout the state, you found tacos that weren't just only simple, but were also pushing culinary boundaries, right? Like there was a taco you tasted at El Paso's Taqueria El Tiger, topped with a smoky kimchi salsa. Tell me about that taco.
Yes. So that is the tripe and trembloso taco, again, on a nixtamalized corn tortilla. Now, tripe and squishily wiggly chicharron are not uncommon tacos, right?
Yeah.
But the fact that he uses onions and this salsa morita soaked kimchi just takes it over the top. And it's just always a joy.
You make it sound like a joy.
Yeah, right?
Also, tripe brings me back to childhood. I mean, we Asians, we love all parts of a pig.
So do us Latinos, right?
Yeah. All right. So after you chomped your way through 1,200 different tacos, Jose, what did this journey teach you about how the taco tradition is evolving in Texas?
It's clear to me that the taco will do what the taco will do. That it is not willing to be confined to a box. There's absolutely no boundary that it can't overcome.
I love that idea. That is Texas Monthly's taco editor, Jose Relat. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio. We broadcast at 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.9 FM in Atchison, or always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Farmers Market every Saturday morning from 7:30 to 11:30 at 824 New Hampshire Street, downtown Lawrence. April through November, rain or shine. Find Lawrence Farmers Market on Facebook for more information.
Stay with us. Coming up in our next half hour, an update of news headlines. We will talk about concerns about houses out in North Carolina's Outer Banks just literally falling into the ocean. We will also hear a spooky story taken from the Haunted States of America. This is a new anthology of ghost stories featuring a story from every state. It's all coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Raven Bookstore, independently serving the local community for over 30 years. The Raven Bookstore is located at 809 Mass Street in Lawrence or online at ravenbookstore.com.
Red flag warning, very high grassland fire danger till 8 p.m. for Clay, Cloud, Dickinson, Geary, Morris, Ottawa, and Riley counties. Gusty winds in that area up to 40 miles per hour. Red flag warning till 8 o'clock tonight for Chase, Greenwood, Wilson, and Woodson counties. Gusty winds up to 50 miles an hour in your region. It's going to be pretty breezy tonight everywhere in the KPR listening area. Lows tonight in the upper 60s. Wind advisories in effect pretty much all day tomorrow for pretty much the entire KPR listening area. It's 84 degrees in Lawrence. It's 520.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Vending machines are one of the newest tools in the fight to reduce overdose deaths in the U.S. These specialized vending machines dispense clean syringes, pipes for smoking crack or meth, Narcan, and more. From member station WBUR, Martha Biebinger reports.
This machine, painted with a spray of colorful triangles, sits at the entrance to an office that hands out sterile drug use supplies. But Berkshire Harm Reduction, in the small, quaint city of North Adams, Massachusetts, is only open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m.
So if they're closed, I got this.
A man named Brian pats the machine. Before it arrived in August, Brian was taking risks he knew he shouldn't. We're only using Brian's first name because he buys and uses illegal drugs.
I don't shoot up that much, but someone should give me something. And if it's late at night, I don't want to use their needle, but I really want to do this, you know?
So Brian would try to sterilize a used needle to avoid getting hepatitis C or HIV. Now, on nights and weekends, Brian can tap a code into the vending machine for free sterile needles and other items aimed at reducing the harm of drug use. Today, Brian can check for fentanyl in the crack he smokes.
So I want to get the fentanyl test strips, so I'll type in 100 and press pound. I think that's what that is.
There's plenty of Narcan in the machine in case any of Brian's buddies needs to reverse an overdose. A study in the journal Annals of Medicine suggests Narcan in vending machines reduced overdose deaths in southern Nevada by 15% in 1 year. In Cincinnati, analysts say 24/7 access to supplies helps slow the spread of HIV. Sarah Whaley at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health argues the benefits of vending machines outweigh the dangers. She says the machines do not lead to more needles littering the ground or more drug use nearby.
So no increase in crime rates, no increases in loitering, none of, I think, the general concerns that people have.
Critics also argue that giving people needles or pipes enables or encourages drug use. Chief John Batiste, who co-chairs the Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs Committee for the International Association of Chiefs of Police, doesn't buy it.
People who come to these machines have already made their decision, or they're already using drugs. So I don't see how it's encouraging.
What's in a harm reduction vending machine varies. Narcan and condoms are common. Pipes and syringes are not. They're banned as drug paraphernalia in 11 states. Chief Batiste does not take a position on what to offer, but he supports the vending machine option.
We're in a sad state of affairs as a country. I mean, we are losing thousands upon thousands of lives. So for creativity and thinking outside the norm, it has to be on the table.
The machines allow clients to access supplies after hours, but they do not provide counseling or support. So Sarah DeJesus at Berkshire Harm Reduction turns the machine off when the office is open.
And they have to come in and reconnect with us so that we're talking about what substances they're using, what supplies they're getting, and just overall how they're doing.
Federal grants and money from opioid settlements are helping boost machine sales. The company that makes the one in North Adams says it has sold hundreds across 35 states. Finding locations can be tough. Massachusetts bought 14 machines last year and has only placed one so far. For NPR News, I'm Martha Biebinger in North Adams, Massachusetts.
The destruction that Hurricane Helene left behind in North Carolina's western mountains has overshadowed another climate-related disaster at the other end of the state. Rising sea levels there are causing houses to fall into the ocean at an accelerating pace. It's a slow-moving disaster with implications for coastal communities around the country. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports on North Carolina's Outer Banks.
Rodanthe is among more than half a dozen communities scattered along the 70-mile-long Cape Hatteras National Seashore. Houses here are built on pilings high above the sand, but where the seashore's superintendent, Dave Halleck, was standing on a recent day, they're no longer out of reach of the Atlantic.
Before those three houses collapsed, we had a house collapse here on August 16th. So it's been four houses just within the last couple of months.
Bringing the total to 10 collapsed houses in the tiny village in the past 4 years. And more are poised to fall in any time because the beach is washing away. That erosion has been turbocharged by rising sea levels fueled by human-caused climate change. Halleck pointed to one house now at sea, totally surrounded by water. Nearby, other houses have waves wash under them at high tide. More and more, the problem on the minds of officials like Halleck isn't how to save such houses, it's how to remove them before they collapse into the sea and leave leaking septic systems and scattered debris for miles down the beach.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Halleck's uniform had drawn the attention of Tim and Heather Manbevers, late-season tourists from Ohio visiting Nag's Head, about 30 miles north. They'd driven down just to see the place where houses are falling in. Tim Manbevers gestured at the house surrounded by water and asked the question a lot of people have.
I just wonder why they just let them go into the ocean.
Because it's expensive to tear them down.
Really?
I'm guessing most of them would rather wait for it to collapse and then they would be able to get some reimbursement from their insurance company.
Otherwise, the owners may have to pay out of their own pocket for tearing down a house before it falls. Rodanthe isn't the only place where key buffers of dune and beach have been eaten away by erosion. More than 750 homes along North Carolina's coast are now considered threatened, according to a report released in August by the state and the National Park Service.
So we're looking at, you know, several hundred structures that could be put at risk due to a major storm or major erosion event that could happen pretty much any time.
Tancred Miller is director of the State Division of Coastal Management, and like Halleck, was part of the group that developed the report. It made recommendations for ways the local, state, and federal governments could remove houses before they fall, but there's little funding for any of it.
Bottom line is there really is no silver bullet.
The problem looms in other states, too, says Rob Young, director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University.
The homes that are being lost in Rodanthe are a harbinger for things to come on shorelines across the East Coast and the Gulf Coast of the United States of America.
Those regions are especially vulnerable to climate-driven sea level rise. He says the nation is far from coming to terms with the idea that so many structures will have to come down, let alone coming up with long-term plans and funding for what he calls a managed retreat from the sea.
We cannot hold every shoreline in place for forever. You know, at the moment, we are almost literally trying to build one beach from Saco, Maine to Padre Island, Texas, by pumping sand and doing what we call beach nourishment projects.
Young says the wisest course in Rodanthe may be to find a way to buy out the most threatened homes, something the county is trying to do now, while working to put systemic fixes in place like those recommended in the report.
What we're learning from Rodanthe is that we don't have a great approach in place for how we can keep these homes from toppling into the sea.
But whether we manage that retreat from the water or let it happen chaotically on its own, it will happen. The sea, he says, is coming. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Rodanthe, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
Supporters of Vice President Harris are aiming to win part of a Republican constituency, white evangelical voters.
To win some of these swing states, we don't have to win everybody. We just have to win enough to win this election and protect our Constitution.
The Evangelical Vote on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Jay Schaefer will be your local host with the latest national, international, and regional news.
Become a KPR sponsor and your business can harness the trust and credibility of public radio. 82% of listeners take action because of an announcement heard on NPR. Learn more at sponsorship.kansaspublicradio.org.
Up next, we have news headlines. Stay tuned. It is 87 degrees in Manhattan. It is 90 in Chanute. It is 5:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, we look at the dropping enrollment of black men at historically black colleges and universities.
You attend an HBCU for an education and not a degree. And as an assistant provost, that's not a popular thing to say.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Virginia Republicans are asking the Supreme Court to remove 1,600 people from the state's voter rolls. NPR's Nina Totenberg says the appeal follows two lower court decisions that found the state was illegally purging voters ahead of the election.
Virginia's Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin signed an executive order on the 90th day prior to the election. It permitted systematic voting roll purges to continue in order to prevent non-citizens from voting, he said. The Justice Department and voting rights groups challenged the move, and two lower courts ruled in their favor, blocking Youngkin's purge order. Both courts said the order is illegal under a federal law that bars such systematic purges in the 90 days leading up to an election. Now, with just 8 days before the election, Virginia is asking the Supreme Court to allow the voter purges to continue. The case is the first of what are likely to be multiple election appeals that will come before the Supreme Court in the coming days and even weeks. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Struggling airplane maker Boeing has launched a stock offering aimed at raising up to $19 billion. NPR's Joel Rose says Boeing is looking to shore up its balance sheet in the midst of an ongoing strike.
Boeing says it will raise billions of dollars by selling stock and other securities. The company needs the infusion of capital to preserve its investment-grade credit rating. Boeing is bleeding cash as it deals with production problems and a strike by its machinists union that's now in its seventh week. The work stoppage hobbled production at Boeing's airplane factories in the Pacific Northwest, contributing to a $6 billion quarterly loss for the company. The machinists union, which represents 33,000 members, says it's been in contact with the U.S. Department of Labor in an effort to get back to the bargaining table with Boeing. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Well, stocks finished higher on Wall Street today. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Opponents of the death penalty in Kansas were in court today to testify in the first of many hearings on capital punishment. National legal groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, are challenging the death penalty in Wyandotte County District Court. They say it's racially discriminatory. Alex Valdez, a staff attorney for the ACLU, says black people are struck from juries at higher rates because they are more likely to oppose the death penalty.
Yes, it's horrible that racism infects at every single level, but it's unimaginably wrong that it could lead to someone's death at the hands of the state.
Wyandotte County District Attorney Mark Dupree said the challenge is premature because the defendant in the case being cited has not yet been sentenced. Kansas lawmakers heard arguments today on whether medical marijuana should be legal in the state. Sam Jones is with Kansas Natural Remedies, a company that grows and sells hemp. He cited a recent poll by the Midwest Newsroom and Emerson College that found nearly 73% of Kansans support the legalization of medical marijuana.
And with that information, I really liked what one of the previous testifiers said is, you know, he said, let's not be a nanny state.
Data released today from Fort Hays State University's annual Kansas Speaks survey aligns with the Midwest Newsroom poll when it comes to medical marijuana. It also found 61.3% of Kansans support legalizing recreational marijuana. Catcher Salvador Perez became the first member of the Kansas City Royals to be awarded the Roberto Clemente Award in recognition of humanitarian work. Greg Eklund has more.
Salvador Perez has become well known for his outgoing personality and his easy engagement with fans and young people. Early this summer, he joined in with some neighborhood kids playing baseball and had ended up going viral on social media. He's been an active participant in Kansas City's Urban Youth Academy, but he's also the owner of a youth baseball league in his Venezuelan hometown of Valencia. Other causes he's supported have been in fundraising and awareness for ALS, cancer, and the families of fallen or wounded police officers. The prestigious Clemente Award caps off a multitude of honors for Perez's 13th season with the Royals, including his 9th appearance as a member of the American League All-Star team. I'm Greg Eklund.
Partly cloudy skies this evening, clearing late tonight, breezy with lows in the upper 60s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and downright windy. Highs tomorrow in the lower 80s. Wind gusts coming out of the south up to 50 miles per hour tomorrow. In fact, there is a wind advisory from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. tomorrow for virtually the entire KPR listening area. Tomorrow night, 30% chance of showers after midnight and breezy with lows in the mid-60s. It's 5:35.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. In the crucial battleground state of Pennsylvania, voters have already begun sending in their ballots by mail. Right now, there are several ongoing lawsuits across the state over whose mail-in ballots must be counted. And the final outcome of these cases determine who wins Pennsylvania's electoral votes, which could really matter with polls suggesting we are in for a tight presidential race. NPR voting rights correspondent Hansi Lo Wong has been tracking this and is here now. Hi, Hansi.
Hi, Mary Louise.
What is the focus of these lawsuits?
They're all focused on what to do when a mail-in voter in Pennsylvania returns an absentee ballot on time but doesn't follow other rules for getting their vote counted.
Okay, before we get into the details, who is bringing these lawsuits?
Well, it's been voting rights groups, and they're arguing that sometimes voters make mistakes, and those who do should not have their ballots rejected. But Republican groups have been pushing back, and generally they're arguing in the court that the state's election rules are the rules, and they should be followed exactly. You know, what's interesting is that all of these legal questions could be resolved by state lawmakers. In fact, a bipartisan advisory board recommended changes to Pennsylvania's election law to, quote, eliminate confusion and litigation. But there's been partisan gridlock in Pennsylvania, so voters in the state really have to pay close attention to all the required steps for mail-in voting.
Okay, so they have to do each step exactly as it has been laid out. What are the steps?
If you are voting by mail in Pennsylvania, you have to first seal your completed ballot inside a yellow-colored secrecy envelope and put that yellow envelope inside an outer return envelope. And before you return it, you have to add your signature on that return envelope and handwrite the current date under your signature.
Go back to one of the things you just said about that, the yellow secrecy envelopes, because mm-hmm. those have been the focus of some of this litigation.
Yeah, election officials have been calling ballots that come without those secrecy envelopes naked ballots. And if you're missing that yellow secrecy envelope, your ballot is not supposed to be counted. But there's a lawsuit over whether Pennsylvania voters whose naked ballots are rejected can cast provisional ballots in person on Election Day. And this month, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, yes, those provisional ballots should be counted. But this afternoon, the Republican National Committee asked the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in.
Okay, I got it. And then what about that other step you mentioned, ballots in return envelopes, but that maybe are missing the current date handwritten by the voter?
Right. Some call these undated and misdated ballots. And to be clear, we're talking about ballots that arrive on time. But the issue is about this artifact of Pennsylvania's election rules that require the voter to handwrite the current date on that outer return envelope. And for now, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has ruled these undated or misdated ballots should not be counted. But that may not be the final word before Election Day. I'm watching a case out of Philadelphia that's working its way up the state courts.
Okay, so we're talking about what's happening in Pennsylvania. What should absentee voters in other states be keeping in mind as they're maybe looking at mail-in ballots and we're getting step-by-step closer to Election Day?
You know, mail-in voters in every state should take real care when they're returning their ballots. We often see thousands of ballots rejected in a state's election because of mistakes. And I should point out, tomorrow is the Postal Service's suggested deadline for returning your ballot if it arrives. So it arrives by Election Day. And after that, absentee voters may want to consider returning their ballot in person at their county election office or at a drop box if there's one nearby.
And PR's Hansila Wong, thank you.
You're welcome.
The RLC straddles the border of the former Soviet republics of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. It was once one of the world's largest lakes, but after years of being drained to irrigate crops, it shriveled and nearly disappeared. In a last-ditch effort, Kazakhstan tried to stop the rapid drain of the sea's dwindling waters by building a massive dam. NPR's Above the Fray fellow Valerie Kipnis reports from the shores of the RLC in Kazakhstan.
The village of Tostubek was nearly desolate for 30 years. Omer Serik Ibrahimov grew up without knowing the sea. He only heard about it in his father's stories.
I was born in 1993, and when I was born, the sea was already gone.
As a boy, Ibrahimov played in abandoned boats scattered along a dried-up seabed. When the dam was built, Ibrahimov was 10. And as the water returned, his father taught him how to fish.
So in 1-2 years after building the dam, the water salinity dropped down.
These days, Ibrahimov is one of dozens of fishermen in Tostubek, able to make a living off fishing in what's come to be known, since it's split in two, as the Northern Aral Sea. Out on the blue water, it's hard to imagine the sea was ever at risk of drying up. Wearing thick rubber gloves, fishermen grab breams, asp, and catfish out of fishing nets bobbing in the salty water. They say they can make a decent living now, but worry about how long this will all last.
And the last 2 years, the sea receded about 200 meters from the coastline. It's becoming lower and lower, and I think that it's the main reason why we have less fish now in the RLC, because there is less water.
There are a number of reasons for this. The most obvious being that the dam that contains the Northern Aral Sea is too low, so water spills over it and evaporates. And then there's the river, the Sir Daria, one of two rivers which feeds the Aral Sea. Medieval Islamic texts refer to it as one of the four rivers of paradise. There are songs and stories written about it, but over the years its levels have been slowly dropping. An 8-hour drive through rice plantations upstream, and you can see why. We arrive in the city of Kizlurda. It's in the region closest to the Aral Sea, and it produces nearly all of the country's rice, a food staple in Kazakhstan.
So we are currently at where the Sir Daria River enters the region of Kizlurda, and it goes through this sort of dam-like structure that holds back some of it and diverts the rest to go towards these canals that it's going to feed the rice plantations. And what's left for the actual river to flow to the Aral Sea, it's minimal.
In some parts, the river levels are so low that small islands of sand appear in the middle. And it's not all the rice industry to blame. It's the way that water is managed and used that's inefficient.
A lot of water is lost in the infrastructure, the big, long irrigation canals. Some of them are not lined, some are earthen.
Bolat Bekinyaz is the Vice Minister of Water Resources and Irrigation for all of Kazakhstan. He's dedicated his life to studying the Aral Sea.
In the near future, we will gradually reduce water consumption.
But the situation is urgent. The shrinking of the Aral Sea has itself changed the regional climate.
If we don't adapt, we can lose both rivers, so we must adapt. We must.
Nowhere is this urgency to adapt felt more than the fishing village of Tostubek, right at the end of the river's course. As Ibrahimov pulls out his daily catch, he says his only dream now is for the sea to be restored for good.
If it will continue shrinking or there will be less water or salty, and if you lose fish in the Aral Sea, that will be the biggest problem, tragedy for the villagers.
For the villagers, the farmers, the people of Kazakhstan, and the hopes of fighting climate change in the region. For NPR News, this is Valerie Kipnis reporting from Aralsk in Kazakhstan.
And And you're listening to All Things Considered.
You're listening to All Things Considered on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Laura Lorson. Just in time for Halloween, a cross-country anthology of spooky stories includes a visit to a Kansas landmark. The Haunted States of America features a story from each state. William Mockery of Lawrence represents Kansas with his short story, Midnight in the Garden of Eden, which he discussed with KPR's Kay McIntyre.
It had to be about a local legend or a local landmark from your state. And I didn't really know a whole lot of legends or stories about cryptids from Kansas. And I did some research on the internet. Nothing that I was seeing was really speaking to me. And suddenly it occurred to me, well, one of my favorite places in the state of Kansas is the Garden of Eden in the town of Lucas. And I said, that would be the perfect setting for a story. And as soon as that idea popped in my head, I said, I've got it. This is my idea. And I went with it.
And they're spooky stories, but they're not super scary.
Yeah, nobody's going to be traumatized by these stories. But they are fun, and I think they're delightfully scary. Something I think would be appropriate for young readers, and also for adults, too. I think adults would enjoy these as well.
Can I have you read from Midnight in the Garden of Eden?
Certainly. I was 6 when I saw Samuel Dinsmore. Mom lifted me up in her arms as the tour guide shone a flashlight on his glass-topped casket. Every hair of his long bristly beard was perfectly preserved, but his sunken face was rotting away, shriveled, covered in white, crackling mold. I wriggled out of Mom's arms and screamed my way out of the concrete tomb. I begged her never to take me back. But in Lucas, Kansas, you can never really escape the Garden of Eden. Every visitor to our prairie town stops to see the strange log cabin. Samuel Dinsmore built it from logs of limestone, not wood. He sculpted trees out of concrete, tall as telephone poles, and planted them in his front yard. He filled the branches with concrete people, Bible characters, common American folk, even animals. Tourists flocked from near and far for a peek at the home he called the Garden of Eden, and he gladly showed them around. Now, long after his death, he's still there, in a concrete tomb in the backyard. Before he died, he wrote that on some dark night in the future, he hoped to slip out of his mausoleum and look around. For years, the memory of his face haunted me. Anytime I walked down Kansas Avenue, I crossed to the other side of the street. I looked away, but the concrete people and the concrete trees never did. The back of my neck would tingle, as though they were watching me. All right, we're going to jump ahead in the story just a little bit. The gate creaked eerily. Above my head, words seemed to whisper in the wind. It sounded like, "He's here! He's here!" But the wind stopped, and so did the voices. The door to the concrete tomb was wide open. "Rocky?" I gulped back my dread. I wouldn't take so much as a peek at the decaying corpse. I would just run inside, grab my dog, and hurry back home. The tomb was silent, only a small sliver of lamplight. No trace of Rocky. I turned around to leave, but something drew me back. Morbid curiosity pulled at me. I stepped up to the glass. The coffin was empty.
That was William Mockery reading from Midnight in the Garden of Eden. The short story is the Kansas entry in a new anthology, The Haunted States of America. Actually, two local authors are featured in The Haunted States of America. Dr. Giselle Anatole, the director of the Hall Center for the Humanities at the University of Kansas, has a story. It's called The Ghost Jockey, and it represents the state of Pennsylvania. You can hear her conversation with Kay McIntyre, as well as a longer version of this conversation with William Mockery, at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Taco Zone Catering, your locally owned and operated small business featuring a reimagined menu and expanded catering options for larger parties. Details at thetacozone.com.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 90.3 FM in Chanute. We are always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
Stay tuned. Coming up in our next half hour, an update of news headlines. Then we will find out more about the shortage of IV fluids used in hospitals. It's all connected to Hurricane Helene. We will also have another installment of our Unsung Hero series. And we will meet the Turtle Whisperer. All of this yet to come here on KPR. Stick around. Breezy conditions tonight, lows in the upper 60s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and windy with highs in the lower 80s. Tomorrow, we do have wind advisories in effect throughout the KPR listening area, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Some areas could see wind gusts up to 55 miles per hour tomorrow. It's 84 degrees in Lawrence, 90 in Chanute, 86 in Abilene. It's 10 minutes before 6 o'clock.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The absolute number of black men enrolled at historically black colleges and universities is the lowest it's been since 1976. That's according to recent analysis from the American Institute for Boys and Men, which crunched data from the Department of Education. In fact, black men now currently account for only 26% of the students at HBCUs. Back in 1976, that figure was 38%. Calvin Hadley is invested in closing this gap. He is assistant provost for academic partnerships and student engagement at Howard University, and he is here in the studio with me now. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start by talking about Howard, which, of course, is one of the foremost HBCUs in this country, a long, long list that I cannot recite of incredible alumni, including Vice President Kamala Harris. Let's start there. Are you seeing this decline among black male students where you are there at Howard, just down the road from us?
I am. I'm a Howard alum. And so I remember as a student, the numbers were also pretty stark at that time. I think we were around 33 to 34% when I was a student between 2004 and 2008. Now, as you announced in your introduction, Howard University is around 25% male total. And I think a recent statistic said around 19% black male. And so that is felt on campus. That is felt, I think, in our social clubs. It's felt on the yard. And I think many of our male students have commented that in some of their classes, they're the only male in their class.
So I will just say I did not attend an HBCU. I attended a PWI, a predominantly white institution. But I have so many friends and family members who attended HBCUs. They talk to me about what that experience has meant to them, not just while they're on campus, but when they go out into their professional lives, they stay connected to the HBCU experience. So I just want to ask you, when there are fewer black men on campus, what does that mean? What do we lose when those black men are not as robust a presence on campuses like yours?
By the time students actually come to college, we're dealing with the males that have actually transcended what we call the belief gap. This gap in between what students can actually achieve and what their professors, teachers, counselors believe they can achieve. For black males, that gap is the largest. When they get into the campus experiences are significantly impacted by the imbalance, right? At every educational institution, we want a diversity of experience. And so when you don't have as many males in a classroom, that diversity of experience is significantly impacted. I think we're dealing with some really unique statistics right now. Black males, as we will dive deeper into this in a moment, are graduating at a much lower rate than black females.
And that's across all colleges.
Across all colleges, not just HBCUs.
Right.
This is not an HBCU problem. This is not a PWI problem. This is an American education problem.
The study that we've been talking about, it notes that since 2010, as you point out, black male enrollment has gone down across all colleges. And it also points out that HBCU enrollment has also decreased on the whole, but the decline of black male enrollment at HBCUs outpaces those trends, if only slightly. Can you just explain to me how you understand that gap?
So I want to take a small step back. There are a number of really important things that happened between 2012 and 2022. One of those was the election of President Donald Trump. Another was the murder of George Floyd. I think when those things happen in the United States of America, the HBCU experience had now become a much more attractive proposition. You notice a significant increase in those male applications. While we received 9,700 male applications in 2022-23, we received upwards of 30,000 female applications. Black women are ripping it up. All the statistics show from high school to college to college graduation that the black woman, the black female, is successful today, and the trajectory is going straight up. Unfortunately, when you look at the black male, the exact opposite is the case. What we now will have imbalance in the community that has a significant impact on our ability to create whole families. I think on the ability for us to ensure that our generations after us have additional success and really to have additional mobility.
I want to end on this. You are a product of Howard University. As you point out, you now work for the university and you're raising two young black boys. What's your pitch for why a young black man who might be hearing our conversation in 2024 should choose to attend an HBCU? Why should they?
You attend an HBCU for an education and not a degree. And as an assistant provost, that's not a popular thing to say. The education that you receive in an HBCU transcends the classroom experience. The education exists in between the lines of the pages. HBCUs are created to instill you with the belief that you can be even larger than you can dream, with the sense that I am enough. I can be successful academically, but my world is not simply academics. I can be enough and I can contribute to this society and this space. And so when I'm talking to that young man in 2024, come because we need you. Come because you're important. Come because without you, our community is hurt.
Calvin Hadley, Assistant Provost at Howard University. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a new album out by the Spanish artist Jude Line. It's called Bodiria, and it melds the traditional music of southern Spain with modern electronic production. One song in particular traces the singer's family history, as NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento reports.
When you first hear one of Jude Line's songs, it can transport you back in time. The 21-year-old grew up in Caños de Meca, a small seaside village in the south of Spain. Her music is rooted in the flamenco and Arabic traditions of Andalusia. Other rhythms that are part of her sound and lineage, too, like Venezuelan folklore.
A lot of my family moved there during the civil war in Spain.
Jude Line's dad was born in Madrid, but
he was raised in Venezuela, so he feels Venezuelan.
She honored that on her debut album with this song, Joropo.
So Joropo is a Venezuelan genre, I think Colombian too. Bueno, es música llanera.
It's often led by the bandola and cuatro venezolano, a four-string instrument that Jude Line's dad taught her to play when she was young.
So I called him and I told him, like, hey, papa, quiero hacer este joropo. And he was so excited about going to the studio and being with me and playing the cuatro venezolano. It was really beautiful to share time with my dad in that way and create this with him.
But the song is not a straightforward joropo. There's also Spanish guitar, thumping percussion, flutes.
At the end, I was like so happy because it has these flamenco vibes, Venezuelan vibes. It's a crazy mix of a lot of stuff.
Jude Line says this song reflects the changing generations of her family. Her dad eventually moved back to Spain, where he raised her. But she says that tide of migration across the Atlantic and back, taking one culture, combining it with a new one, is still part of her family's DNA, and it's embedded in her music. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. From Organic Valley, a dairy cooperative of small organic family farms that is dedicated to protecting the land and all the plants and animals that live there. Learn more about Organic Valley at ov.coop. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
NPR is here for the lifelong learners, the investigators, the curious. It's here for you. Keep listening and growing with NPR.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, K210CR Atchison 89.9. K258BT Manhattan 99.5 and at kansaspublicradio.org. Breezy tonight with lows in the upper 60s. We have red flag warnings in effect till 8 p.m. for portions of the KPR listening area. It's 6 o'clock.
This shortage is still touching nearly every hospital in the country.
Hurricane Helene damaged a crucial factory making IV fluids. Weeks later, hospitals are still scrambling to deal with the shortage.
For Monday, October 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump campaign is trying to distance itself from a speaker who made fun of Puerto Rico.
This comedian, he actually talked about people who were native-born and they can vote and they're Americans. So this is very delicate for the Trump campaign.
Later, Mexico City celebrates St. Jude, patron saint of lost causes.
Plus, baseball returns to a field once used by Japanese Americans incarcerated in Southern California during World War II.
A lot of things that sustained the community while they were in the camp was baseball. It was the thing that reminded them that they were still American.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Israel's parliament has passed legislation banning the United Nations' main aid agency for Palestinians from operating in Israel. As NPR's Daniel Estrin explains from Tel Aviv, the Biden administration warned Israel not to implement the move.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, has been the main UN group for decades, providing aid to Palestinians in Gaza and aiding Palestinian refugees uprooted from their homes in Israel's founding war. Israel has long seen the agency as perpetuating Palestinians' refugee status in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel has accused members of the UN agency of having ties to Hamas. The laws passed today by a vast majority of Israel's lawmakers ban the UN agency from operating in Israel and prohibits it from having official contact with Israel. The State Department says it's deeply concerned. It says UNRWA plays a critical humanitarian role in Gaza, and the Israeli ban could have implications under U.S. law. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Former President Donald Trump is campaigning in Atlanta, fresh off the latest controversy surrounding his campaign. The warm-up at a rally last night in Madison Square Garden by a comedian that included offensive and racist remarks. What was billed as a New York City homecoming of sorts for Trump, largely overshadowed by comments by Tony Hinchcliffe, who, among other things, described Puerto Rico as a floating island of garbage. For his part, Trump used the opportunity to propose a tax credit for family members who take care of a parent or loved one. Organ donor registries say they're seeing an increase in people removing themselves from lists to donate organs for transplantation. More from NPR's Rob Stein.
Donate Life America says an average of 170 people a day remove their names from the National Donor Registry in the week since NPR reported allegations about an incident in Kentucky 3 years ago. The case involved a drug overdose patient who woke up as he was being wheeled into an operating room in Kentucky to have his organs removed. State organ donor registries say they're also seeing similar trends. Organ procurement officials are pleading with the public to be cautious about the report until more is known. The Kentucky Attorney General and federal health officials are investigating the incident. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Fast food chain McDonald's says it has ruled out its ground beef as a source of an E. coli outbreak that led to the one death in Colorado and sickened dozens more people in 13 states. The company in a statement over the weekend said as a result it will resume selling Quarter Pounder burgers at hundreds of locations beginning this week. McDonald's says the U.S. Food and Drug Administration continues to focus on slivered onions from a single supplier as a likely source of contamination. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today. The Dow is up 273 points. The Nasdaq gained 48 points. You're listening to NPR. Delta Airlines is suing the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike over a global tech outage in July that led a number of major carriers to cancel thousands of flights, but none more so than Delta. As Marlon Hyde of member station WABE reports, CrowdStrike has sued the airline in response, saying Delta is trying to shift the blame for its own failure to modernize its IT systems.
Delta claims CrowdStrike failed to test the update that led to Microsoft systems going down, costing the airline $500 million due to canceled flights. CrowdStrike denies these claims. Ramnath Shalapa is a professor at Emory's Goizueta Business School who studies aviation.
Essentially, they are suggesting that, yes, we may have caused the first piece of this domino to fall, but it is your poor infrastructure that really led to the kind of the enormous amount of delays that have actually occurred.
Meanwhile, federal officials continue to investigate Delta over refunds and reimbursements to affected customers. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
It seems a thousand flowers can bloom when warring factions lay down their weapons, and in some cases, literally. In Colombia, after more than five decades of violence, a 2016 peace deal with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as the FARC, has made it safer for researchers to enter the country. That increased safety has led to the discovery of new animal and plant species, from brilliantly colored orchids to tiger-striped frogs. Scientists say they found roughly triple the number of new plant species in Colombia each year since the peace accord. Still, crime does remain high there and continues to make it dangerous for environmentalists. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Bowersock Capital Partners, a woman-owned and managed financial management firm with deep Kansas roots. Sanctuary Securities member FINRA SIPC, advisory services through Sanctuary Advisors LLC, a registered investment advisor.
It's 84 degrees in Lawrence. It is 6:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. IV fluids used in hospitals are still in short supply after Hurricane Helene shut down a key North Carolina factory that makes them. The closure has put hospitals in crisis mode and some patients in limbo, as NPR pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin reports.
Katie Adace has been trying to get a diagnosis for her chronic pelvic pain for years, but so far, no doctor has been able to figure it out.
I couldn't do laundry or walk to the grocery store or like even cook without having to then take 3 or 4 hours to lay in bed with a heating pad. So it's been really scary.
The 26-year-old biologist eventually got referred to a physician who specializes in endometriosis. By the time she got the appointment, though, she had moved across the country. Diagnosing the cause of her symptoms required a surgery. The procedure was scheduled for early October. She and her husband flew back to West Virginia a few days before the pre-op appointment. While they were there, Hurricane Helene hit. 4 days before the scheduled surgery, a nurse called. The surgery was canceled because they didn't have enough IV fluids.
I was having such a hard time processing what she was even saying to me that I was just really quiet.
Her diagnosis would have to wait. That's a problem for patients around the country in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. The storm flooded a Baxter International factory in North Carolina that was making 60% of the national supply of IV fluids. Hospitals have had to adjust by conserving IV fluids for the neediest patients. Often that means asking emergency room patients to drink a Gatorade or a Pedialyte instead of getting an IV, but it also means canceling scheduled surgeries and procedures.
This shortage is still touching nearly every hospital in the country.
Now I've talked to hospitals coast to coast, border to border, all over the country who are needing to engage in those kinds of measures.
That was Dr. Chris DiRienzo, chief physician executive of the American Hospital Association. The surgeries most likely to be postponed or canceled include certain bladder surgeries, which require a lot of IV fluids, some heart procedures, orthopedic surgeries, and things like caviodaces diagnostic surgery. But it varies from hospital to hospital. At Mass General Hospital in Boston, Dr. Paul Bidinger has handled disaster preparedness for more than two decades. He says the IV fluid shortage is a crisis.
We have activated our emergency operations plan for the system, and we've been in that mode now for weeks, the last couple weeks. And that is an all hands on deck. It's the same thing we do for a hurricane or the Boston Marathon bombing or COVID.
He said his hospital has been able to reduce IV fluid use by 50%, but it has taken a huge effort, and procedures still get pushed off. When it's a knee or hip replacement surgery that gets canceled, sometimes the patient has been waiting months already, and rebooking can take time.
And so they're in pain. They're at risk of falling. There are very real consequences to patients and their families.
Things are getting better as Baxter and the government work to bridge the supply gap while the North Carolina factory is cleaned up for reopening in phases. But it will take time for that supply to hit hospital loading docks. Baxter says it hopes to resume some production of the highest priority IV fluids very soon and is ahead of schedule. Some patients NPR spoke to say their canceled surgeries have since been rescheduled and happened without incident. As for Katie Dace in West Virginia, her surgery has been rescheduled for November 1st.
So that leaves me to, you know, fix up all of my logistics. So I'm racking up medical debt. I'm racking up debt from traveling. I'm feeling guilty that, you know, my husband took off work for nothing.
She says she's lucky to have the support system she has, but patients are paying a price even if things work out in the end. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
During World War II, the U.S. government incarcerated more than 120,000 Japanese Americans at camps across the country. One of the largest was Manzanar in the remote California desert. The camp was mostly demolished after the war, but for the last year, volunteers have been working to restore the baseball diamond that incarcerees once played on. Last weekend, for the first time since the war, it hosted a game, and NPR's Adrian Florido was in the bleachers.
All right, who's ready to have his very first exhibition game here at the Manzanar Baseball Field?
The face-off was between two well-established Japanese-American amateur teams, the Little Tokyo Giants from Los Angeles against the Templars from the city of Lodi.
Everybody get in here.
Before the first pitch, Dan Kwong, first baseman for the Giants, spoke to his team in a huddle.
You were the first people to play ball in over 8 years. Think about all the spirits who have played on this field. Let it hit you however it hits you. And have a good time.
Yes, sir.
Hey, babe, all right. Let's go.
Giants. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kwong on three. One, two, three. Kwong!
The Manzanar site is now administered by the National Park Service, but Kwong, an artist from the city of Santa Monica, was the leading force behind its ball field's restoration. He worked with volunteers for a year to clear tumbleweeds and rebuild the backstop. It's an all-dirt diamond in the desert, just like during the war. Two benches for dugouts, simple wooden bleachers. There's no outfield fence. If the ball lands in the tumbleweeds, it's a home run. An old camp guard tower still looms over the field. Dan Kwong's parents were among the 10,000 people held at Manzanar.
The reason why people were here, put in this camp, is because it was a time when Japanese heritage people were hated and feared in this country and distrusted in this country. And yet, they still were going to play the American game.
Carson, shorten the swing up a little bit, okay?
Marty Sakata is manager of the Lodi JACL Templar.
It's amazing to be out here in a field basically the same as during camp. This all dirt, rocky, slow field but with tumbleweeds. It's fantastic. It is fantastic.
Segregation before the war kept Japanese Americans out of white baseball leagues, so they formed their own. Sakata's team has been active since 1915, except when its players were sent to Manzanar during the war. Mike Furutani is a pitcher for the Templars. His uncles were incarcerated.
A lot of the people say a lot of things that sustained the community while they were in the camp was baseball. It was the thing that reminded them that they were still American. Right? It sucked, but they could still play ball and forget for 3 hours
all the horrible things that are happening.
Furutani is one of the older players on his team. He says before today, many of the younger ones had only heard stories about the places where their ancestors were locked up.
But I don't think they've ever experienced how far, how desolate, and how, you know, horrible the situation was, the injustice.
Oh, yeah!
20-year-old Kainoa Sue is a star hitter on the Giants. He got the first hit and scored the first run of the game.
I got butterflies in my stomach right now just talking about it. I have lineage that was in this camp, so now being able to play on the same field in the same general area that they were in, it's insane.
Melinda Yamane Crawford was in the bleachers cheering on her son Robert, and also thinking about her dad, who served in the war, and a friend who had been locked up here.
That's a mix of emotions. You could tell I'm probably a little emotional right now because I'm honoring my father, I'm honoring my friend, but I'm also enjoying the game of baseball and watching my son carry on that tradition.
So who won the first game played on Manzanar's diamond in over 80 years? The Little Tokyo Giants. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Manzanar, California.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Donald Kabara. In the spring of 2023, Kabara visited Washington, D.C. with family members, including his son, Tim. On the last day of the trip, Kabara was scheduled to fly back home to Oklahoma, a trip that would begin with a ride to the airport on D.C.'s subway system, the Metro. Well, after they arrived at the Metro station, Tim insisted on walking his father inside. But when they got there, Kabara wasn't sure which train to take to get to the airport.
So I approached the attendants, a middle-aged woman, and asked her for directions to the train to Reagan Airport. She told me to pass through the gate, take the escalator down, and go to the right, and the train should arrive there. So I gave my son one hug and a second hug, and he was standing next to me at her booth, so she saw that it was a special moment for me. And I went down the escalator and was waiting for my train when all of a sudden my son appeared next to me. And I asked, "What are you doing here?" He told me the attendant told him he should come down and give me an extra hug goodbye. He gave me one last hug and went back up, and I went along my way to the airport. What impressed me is that this woman was so perceptive that she could see just by our actions that it was a special moment, and she perceived, not only perceived and understood it, she had the compassion to take action and support me in my life. I am a widower and I live alone in Oklahoma, and my son lives in Wisconsin, so I don't get to see him that often. So that hug was a special hug, not just from my son, but also it represented the thoughtfulness, kindness, and care that this woman had for someone passing through the station.
Donald Kabara lives in Norman, Oklahoma, and you can find more stories of unsung heroes at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers. Online instruction available anytime, anywhere for students to catch up or get ahead in reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodBell.com/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence. also at 91.3 FM in Junction City and many other frequencies all around the state. You can listen online and see a complete listing of all of our frequencies at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, asking listeners when they last visited a dentist. For a preventive checkup, dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find.
Thanks for spending part of your day with us. We are with you for about another 41 minutes. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, as hurricanes become more intense, evacuations are becoming more expensive. Talk about that. Also, voting day at a tribal school in Arizona. They're voting on what to have for lunch on Election Day. And we will learn more about the Mexico City celebration of St. Jude, all coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Kansas City Zoo and Aquarium, open year-round, featuring nearly 10,000 animals. Admission supports the zoo's conservation fund, preserving wildlife at home and around the world. More at kansascityzoo.org.
The holidays are coming. They will be here before you know it, and so will KPR's annual Big Band Christmas Concert featuring Kansas City Jazz Orchestra. That's going to happen Saturday night, December 14th. A great night of Kansas City swing, Christmas carols, and dancing at Liberty Hall in downtown Lawrence. Tickets on sale now at the Liberty Hall box office and Ticketmaster.com. All the details at kansaspublicradio.org. Wind advisories tomorrow for pretty much the entire day, and this is for all of the KPR listening area. It's 6:20.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations order food online from a nationwide network of restaurants, with tools designed to help save time and manage food spend all on one platform. Learn more at EasyCater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As October comes to an end, many labor unions are blanketing swing states with canvassers going door to door. The AFL-CIO estimates that one in five voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania live in union households. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports from Philadelphia.
Skylar Goodman has been knocking doors in every corner of Philadelphia since July.
I was averaging like 5-7 miles a day.
Today, she's headed to Northeast Philly, not far from where she grew up. It's a working-class neighborhood of row homes.
The best thing in the world when you're canvassing, go right up and down the blocks.
Goodman works for the Painters Union. She's part of the AFL-CIO's mammoth effort to do labor-to-labor outreach.
People want to talk to somebody like them. And we do like the trade-to-trade, the women-to-women.
Canvassers like Goodman have been out reminding them that Kamala Harris has stood with striking workers and helped to create good union jobs in their city. They've tried to draw a contrast with Donald Trump, knowing the former president has substantial support among union workers, especially white men. They've highlighted things he said about how he hates paying overtime and about how he supports right-to-work laws, which allow workers to opt out of paying union dues. Goodman fears if elected, Trump would act on that.
Having a national right-to-work law would severely weaken unions' ability to organize and to do what we do for workers.
But the persuasion phase of this campaign is largely over. Now it's all about making sure people actually vote. Pennsylvania was decided by just 44,000 votes in 2016 and just over 80,000 in 2020. So even buttoning up a handful of votes matters. But even in blue Philadelphia, it's not the easiest thing. For one thing, a lot of people aren't home. There's only the Ring doorbell to speak to.
We can't answer the door right now, but if you'd like to leave a message, you can do it now.
Hi, how are you? My name's Skylar.
She leaves a door hanger that says, "Workers win with Harris Walls." And then it's on to the next house.
We're going to cross the street here.
Hi, how are you?
A few people who are home say, yeah, I'm voting, but they won't say who they're voting for. We find Vanita Bracey trimming a houseplant on her front porch.
It's personal. Like, I don't have to share that information.
Still, so, Skylar Goodman does what she can to connect with this voter. Yes. When she learns Bracey was a Head Start teacher, she shares some of her own story.
I'm a Head Start kid, so thank you for that. Yeah,
They chat for another 5-10 minutes, talking about early education and other things.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Did you want to hang on to this?
Sure.
Goodman leaves her with a list of union-endorsed candidates and feels pretty good about how Bracey will vote, but she says you never know. About an hour away in the Philly suburb of Norristown, Wernell Martinez is knocking doors for a different labor organization, the Hospitality Union Unite Here. Unlike Goodman, he's not from around here.
So I grew up in Puerto Rico and then we moved to Orlando.
He was hired by Unite Here to knock doors in Pennsylvania, where his background helps him connect with voters like Josephine Villalongo.
¿Vas a votar por Kamala Harris?
Claro.
Yes.
He marks her down as a Harris voter and moves to the next question. How is she planning to vote?
Voy a votar en persona.
En persona?
She says in person, on election day. She points to her minivan.
Esa guagua va llena. Esta. Va llena para allá.
Okay.
A votar.
This van is full the people who go into voting.
Unfortunately, one person in her family who won't be able to vote is her 20-year-old son, Kenyo. Wernell Martinez discovered he wasn't registered to vote. But turns out the deadline to be eligible to vote in this election had just passed. A reminder of just how little time is left for both sides to make their final push in yet another close election. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Norristown, Pennsylvania.
In north central New Jersey, there's a special kind of sanctuary for turtles from all over the world. It's run by a man devoted to giving these animals a better life. Science reporter Ari Daniel went to see the effort up close.
Maurice Rodriguez has a sizable backyard, and it's filled with enclosures and tanks he's built that are just teeming with turtles.
Individuals, I'm at about the 200 mark. If I had room here, I would have thousands of turtles.
Rodriguez walks me over to an outdoor pen filled with shrubs and plants.
So we're going to start here.
I soon spot a dark shell splashed with bright yellow.
There's a box turtle in the corner here.
Yeah. I would put this species up against any other turtle species on the planet in terms of beauty. And that's what makes them valuable.
And by valuable, he means at risk of being poached. Inside this pen, there are 98 box turtles that were among those confiscated at the airport in Los Angeles last year.
They were headed out to the pet trade in Asia.
When Federal Fish and Wildlife found these turtles stuffed into multiple suitcases, each one had been duct taped shut and placed in a sock.
Smuggling trade is just a cruel thing for the animals. You know, with the stress, everything, it's just terrible.
This is where Rodriguez enters the picture. He's co-founder of the Turtle Conservancy, a group that cares for illegally trafficked turtles once they're apprehended. The team nurses them back to health with the hope of returning them to the wild.
That is the end game here.
An end game that, until recently, wasn't possible. But now, DNA technology has gotten good enough and cheap enough that Rodriguez and his colleagues can use the genetics of certain species to pinpoint an individual's rough origins.
So these turtles are wood turtles. They're in this temporary tub.
They've been matched to a population living in Pennsylvania.
And Pennsylvania agreed to take them back into the wild.
Rodriguez says sometimes the turtles come from a part of the world in turmoil or without sufficient law enforcement, so repatriation isn't feasible since they'll just be poached again. Rodriguez has a bunch of turtles from outside the U.S., including the Congo, China, Indonesia, and one of his favorites from Myanmar, a big green Burmese roofed turtle with a distinctive upturned nose.
The only turtle I really name, her name is Ruby, because Myanmar is known for its ruby trade. It's like the most precious, you know, gem that they have, and she's my most precious gem here at my house.
Rodriguez is a total turtle softie, something his partner, Fumiji Aoki, can attest to.
Feeding the sick turtles with the chopsticks and...
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. Do you know he hauls all the leaves from my neighborhood so that he can pile the leaves in the playpen, turtle pen.
So they have a nice warm blanket over them during the winter, and they love it.
For some turtle species, this exposure to the seasons is necessary for breeding.
That's important. If a turtle is becoming extinct or there's a problem in the habitat, you need to be able to set up an insurance colony.
Before I go, Rodriguez holds up a turtle from Australia, the size of a dinner plate.
Well, hold on. I want to show you something. If you take your finger, here, get your finger.
I gently push the side of the turtle's body.
She's full of eggs. You could feel the eggs.
Wow, they feel kind of like a little sack of beans.
Yeah. It's probably going to be in the next few weeks she'll want to lay those eggs.
We admire her for a moment longer before Rodriguez lowers her back into the water. She slips away to continue creating a new batch of little turtles, babies that Rodriguez will shower with the affection that all the turtles here have come to flourish on. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
This is NPR News.
Supporters of Vice President Harris are aiming to win part of a Republican constituency, white evangelical voters.
To win some of these swing states, we don't have to win everybody. We just have to win enough to win this election and protect our Constitution.
The Evangelical Vote, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR station's Morning Edition with Jay Schaefer, Michelle Martin, and Layla Fadel.
Support for KPR comes from Cromwell Environmental, serving Kansas and Missouri customers since 1982, offering testing and solutions for mold, lead, and asbestos problems. More information at cromwellenvironmental.com.
Up next, we have news headlines. Lows in the upper 60s tonight and breezy. Wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour in and around Lawrence and Topeka. It is 6:30.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A tribal school in Arizona is teaching its students about voting and democracy.
On the ballot, what kind of lunch they will serve at the cafeteria on Election Day.
I voted for chicken nuggets.
I voted for pizza.
That story after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The humanitarian crisis in Gaza is worsening, and Israel is under increased U.S. pressure to ramp up aid. Providing that much-needed assistance is now at risk, though, after lawmakers in Israel passed a couple of measures today restricting the U.N. aid agency, UNRWA, from operating on Israeli soil. The votes come after Israeli forces carried out airstrikes on Iran over the weekend in retaliation for missile strikes on Tel Aviv earlier this month. Sanam Vakil is the director of the Middle East program at the London-based think tank Chatham House.
We've been waiting for this counterstrike from Israel to Iran for over 3.5 weeks. And certainly this strike has been relatively targeted. The supreme leader of Iran is vowing some sort of response, but I don't expect that to come right now with over a week to go to the U.S. election.
A Louisiana state trooper has avoided jail time in a plea deal stemming from charges in the deadly arrest about 5 years ago of black motorist Ronald Green. NPR's Debbie Elliott has more.
Former master trooper Corey York once faced the felony charge of negligent homicide, but pleaded no contest to misdemeanor battery in exchange for a year of probation. Ronald Green died in police custody after a high-speed chase with state troopers near Monroe, Louisiana. Authorities told his family he died in a car crash, but body cam footage obtained by the Associated Press more than a year later showed five white officers brutally beating and jolting him with stun guns, dragging him by ankle shackles, and leaving him face down, begging for mercy. Green's mother, Mona Harden, called the plea deal wrong and unfair. The family has filed a civil wrongful death lawsuit, and the possibility of federal charges remains.
This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. A survey released today by the Docking Institute at Fort Hays State University finds that support for Medicaid expansion remains high in Kansas. The annual Kansas Speaks survey found that 72% of Kansans support expanding Medicaid and 76% think doing so would help rural hospitals remain in business. That support is up slightly from last year. Democratic Governor Laura Kelly has tried for years to expand Medicaid, but the Republican supermajority in the Kansas legislature has blocked the policy. Alexandra Middlewood is a political science professor at Wichita State University. She says the response highlights how voters' beliefs on key policy issues don't always align with their voting behavior.
We can see that a huge portion of Kansans say that it is, you know, important to some degree, but there are so many other issues, too, that they're being forced to consider when making decisions about who to vote for.
The survey also found that significant majorities of Kansans support legalizing medical and recreational marijuana use. An advisory group created by Kansas education leaders wants to reduce the amount of time students spend on screens. The group is recommending that teachers balance technology with non-digital learning experiences and that school districts not rely on social media to communicate with families. Kim Whitman is a parent in the Shawnee Mission School District. She says all personal devices should be limited, including headphones and earbuds.
Most of the devices would isolate them to where they're not interacting with their peers, which I think is a huge component of the school day.
The task force voted last week to recommend all Kansas schools ban cell phones for students at every grade level. The Board of Education will vote on the recommendations next month. Catcher Salvador Perez became the first member of the Kansas City Royals to be selected to receive the Roberto Clemente Award in recognition of humanitarian work. Greg Eklin has more.
Salvador Perez has become well known for his outgoing personality and his easy engagement with fans and young people. Early this summer, he joined in with some neighborhood kids playing baseball and had ended up going viral on social media. He's been an active participant in Kansas City's Urban Youth Academy, but he's also the owner of a youth baseball league in his Venezuelan hometown of Valencia. Other causes he's supported have been in fundraising and awareness for ALS, cancer, and the families of fallen or wounded police officers. The prestigious Clemente Award caps off a multitude of honors for Perez's 13th season with the Royals, including his 9th appearance as a member of the American League All-Star team. I'm Greg Eklin.
A representative from Major League Baseball will give the award to Perez tonight prior to Game 3 of the World Series.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Donald Trump made a campaign stop in New York yesterday at a rally in Madison Square Garden. What is making big headlines today are the racist and misogynistic jokes from speakers who came before him, the ones who were warming up the crowd for the former president. And a warning to listeners, the language here is offensive. For example, comedian Tony Hinchcliffe said, "A floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. I think it is called Puerto Rico." Well, Hinchcliffe said that was a joke. It was part of a two-minute riff about Latinos and immigrants.
And these Latinos, they love making babies, too. Just know that. They do. They do.
It gets quite crude after that. In response, a representative of Trump's campaign said in a statement that, quote, "this joke does not reflect the views of President Trump or the campaign." For his part, Hinchcliffe said he loves Puerto Rico and takes vacations there. Well, joining us to talk this through is journalist Julio Vaquero, host of Noticias Telemundo. Welcome.
Thank you.
What reaction are you hearing today to these comments?
Well, a lot. People really outraged, to be honest. Prominent Puerto Rican voices offering their public support for Vice President Kamala Harris in the hours after this Trump rally in New York, including Bad Bunny, the musician, Jennifer Lopez, Ricky Martin. All of them together have 300 million followers in social media, and all of them shared this video of Vice President Kamala Harris talking about her plans for Puerto Rico. And here in Telemundo,
just to clarify, you're talking about they were sharing the plan. Vice President Harris released her own plan for Puerto Rico, right?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Here in Telemundo, we've been trying to hear from voters themselves, from Puerto Rican voters. And in general, I can say there's outrage and they are disgusted. Some lawmakers, Puerto Rican lawmakers, Republicans in Florida, which is one of the states that have the largest population of Puerto Ricans, Maria Elvira Salazar, Carlos Jimenez, Senator Rick Scott, all of them expressing their outrage after this comment.
You're nodding to Puerto Ricans in Florida. There are millions of Puerto Ricans spread across the U.S., including important swing states, Pennsylvania, for example. How do comments like this make sense at a campaign rally for a candidate who is trying to pick up Latino votes, not scare them away?
Totally. And it actually happened the same day Kamala Harris was campaigning in Pennsylvania, talking with Puerto Rican voters. So there are around 500,000 Puerto Rican voters or Puerto Rican descendants who live in Pennsylvania, specifically in the Philadelphia area or the surroundings. And it can be very critical if you think about the margins and the small difference by which President Biden won the state in 2020, only a little bit more than 80,000 votes. So it doesn't really mean that all Puerto Ricans are going to vote against President Trump, but it is a reminder of how narrow the margins are, how they have been very narrow in recent elections, and the dangers of really outraging a big group of voters a week before voting ends.
How much weight, how much credence do you give to the comments from the Trump campaign saying, look, this was a joke, it doesn't reflect the views of former President Trump?
Well, yeah, I mean, they were quick to try and clean up what happened. The truth is that the whole rally had a very intense rhetoric, and we've heard this rhetoric across the whole campaign. Now, President Trump has been careful to, when he talks about migrants, to really say migrants and sometimes specify undocumented immigrants. Here, this comedian went like one step further, and he actually talked about people who were native-born and they can vote and they are Americans, right? So this is very delicate for the Trump campaign.
Mm. I mean, just to take a step back, I know you have been reporting on the Latino vote in swing states. How important is that vote likely to be in this 2024 election?
It's going to be crucial. Again, if we think about the margins, one in every four voters in Arizona, one in every four voters in Nevada are Latinos. And these are two very important swing states. Pennsylvania, same thing, around 600,000 Latino voters that can really make a difference when we think about the small margins that will give a victory to one or the other candidate. So we've been working on a podcast series and traveling around these swing states. We called it El Péndulo because there's no word to refer to a swing state in Spanish. So we think about this pendulum to make a comparison of how these states could go one way or the other. And we try to really meet Latinos where they are and understand what are the issues that they really care about and can really define their vote. We find a very diverse community, a very complex and dynamic community that's living in some of the most important states in this election cycle.
Julio Vaquero is host of Noticias Telemundo and of the special series El Péndulo from Radio Ambulante Studios and Noticias Telemundo. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Destructive hurricanes have affected millions of Americans this year and forced many to evacuate. Stephen Basaja of the Gulf States Newsroom reports that hurricane evacuations have only gotten more expensive.
Hurricane Francine was forecast to go straight through New Orleans in September. There wasn't any evacuation order for the city, but Nick Oquin was worried about power outages while caring for his newborn and decided not to stick around.
It is raining, and it's been raining since I left my house.
So Oquin and his family of four started driving to Alabama, and along the way picked up their first evacuation expense, snacks.
So far, the grapes at $3.99 a pound are pretty much a budget killer so far.
Add in gas, a hotel, and full meals, and Oquin estimates the trip would cost him somewhere between $500 and $2,000. That's roughly what evacuations cost these days, and it's way more than it used to be.
I'm not surprised to see there is a huge price hike on the evacuation expenses in the recent years.
Paula Mazumder is an economist with Florida International University. He says evacuation costs today can be about five times higher compared to 20 years ago. And that's after adjusting for inflation. Mazumder says that's because hurricanes are getting more complex.
For example, think about this Hurricane Milton. In less than 24 hours, it jumped from Category 1 to 5.
Besides being more destructive, these fast-growing storms can catch people off guard, leading to late evacuations, jammed-up roads, packed hotels, and higher prices. Of course, there are ways to keep costs down, like going to a county shelter or staying with family out of town. And when it comes to Hurricane Francine, Nick Oquin was lucky. The storm was weaker than Helene and Milton, and he ended up returning home after just 2 days.
Hey, Steven. We're back home on the couch.
The final cost for his 48-hour evacuation, $505.
Not counting the school supplies that we bought while we were there.
Yeah, we could leave those out. You'd probably need to get those anyway.
Yes, yes.
By evacuation standards, pretty cheap. But he acknowledges that's far from cheap for everyone.
Evacuating is sort of a luxury, you know?
And with hurricane seasons continuing to intensify, that luxury may become more often a necessity, whether or not people can afford it. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Birmingham, Alabama.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Colorado River drought has been so bad for so long that places that were underwater for decades are now out on dry land. And they're starting to grow plants again. Scientists researching the plants are finding thriving native ecosystems. Alex Hager with member station KUNC reports.
When you see a research paper, you see data and conclusions. What you don't see is this, the messy process of science in action.
I guess as an ecologist, I can't quite bring myself to just hack down vegetation.
In a narrow Red Rock Canyon in Utah, Seth Arnes is gently pushing his way through towering, dense grasses, charting a path to his research site along the muddy canyon floor.
Oh, quicksand, quicksand. Oh.
What's the best way around?
You can go through it, but just quickly.
Arnes is an environmental scientist, and getting to his research site requires about a mile of arduous trekking through the kind of desert heat that leaves you dizzy. It's in the triple digits under the southern Utah sun, but eventually the counting can begin.
12, 1, Baccharis salicifolia, 1.
Arnes is producing the first ever serious data on what plants are living here. Tens of thousands of acres that are seeing the light of day after spending decades submerged under Lake Powell. In the mountains of silt left behind by the reservoir, it's mostly native plants taking root, the same kind that were last here in the 1970s, before the area was flooded.
And now not only is it not under the lake, but it turns out nature's doing a pretty good job by itself of coming back and establishing thriving ecosystems.
But it's unclear whether these new, thriving native plant communities might be drowned if Lake Powell's water level rises again. Its future is at a crossroads, as river managers debate new rules that will dictate how much water it should hold. The reservoir is unlikely to ever fill up completely again. Sarah Dant says that means now is a great time to study what the future might hold.
One of the things that is kind of astonishing about natural environments, almost regardless of where you are, is how quickly they can recover if they are able to.
Dan is a retired professor who studies the history of politics and the environment.
We have to be careful of our hubris in, you know, and I'm using air quotes here, managing nature, because you can cooperate with nature, but nature finds a way.
Zach Podmore, a journalist and the author of a book on Lake Powell's future, says nature is doing what humans couldn't, bringing back native plants in an area threatened by invasive species.
That's exactly what's happened in Glen Canyon over the last couple decades, but it's happened completely on its own.
And even though humans have spent millions on native plant programs around the region, we didn't need to intervene here.
The native species have been outcompeting the invasives in a really impressive way.
Podmore says, in a way, our struggles to manage a drying river are revealing an unexpected positive outcome of climate change.
Those trends usually go in one direction, right? The slow degradation of land. But what's happening in Glen Canyon is an ecological rebirth.
The next rules for managing the Colorado River are due in 2026, and they're expected to help write the next chapter for Lake Powell and the things that live in it. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Glen Canyon.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we bring you the latest on everything from the presidential race to what interest rates are doing. But we also share stories that take us into other people's lives.
You actually played your horn while they were inside your skull.
Absolutely. Doesn't everybody?
Listen for the unexpected with the news weekdays on Morning Edition.
Tune in to Morning Edition tomorrow. Actually, Monday through Friday, you can always tune in to Morning Edition, but do it tomorrow, 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations. Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
Support for KPR comes from the Yoga Center of Lawrence, providing Lawrence and surrounding communities with yoga instruction by Iyengar yoga instructors since 1999. Class schedule and registration information at yogacenteroflawrence.org.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence, and many other frequencies as well. Always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Stoneback Appliance in Lawrence, locally owned for over 50 years, featuring new and used appliances from Maytag, Whirlpool, and more. We've got your back at stonebackappliance.com.
We do still have about 10 minutes of All Things Considered yet to come. Stay tuned. If you're joining us on KPR One stations, we have news headlines coming your way at 7:01, followed by Stardate, then 2 hours of classical music with Destiny. If you're joining us on KPR Two, up next we have This American Life. Lows in the upper 60s tonight and breezy winds coming out of the south. Tomorrow, a wind advisory, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. for pretty much the entire KPR listening area. It's 10 minutes before 7.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. As the swing state of Arizona prepares for a national election, the students of Salt River Elementary School have their own voting day. This year, the students at this tribal school had a big decision to make. Is their favorite school lunch pizza or chicken nuggets? It's part of a broader effort to teach kids about democracy and how their voice matters. NPR's Janaki Mehta was there as the students went to the polls.
Yeah. Hey, are we voting today?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Just east of Scottsdale's, excitement around Election Day kicked off at Salt River Elementary. I talked to a couple of kindergartners to get a taste of this school's favorite lunch. The polling was split.
I voted for chicken nuggets.
I voted for pizza.
This morning, Mrs. Meyer's class is getting geared up to cast their ballots. Pom-poms in hand, they're practicing how to spell the word vote with their bodies.
Show me an E, say E.
E.
What's the word?
Vote.
I hear children coming up to me, oh, I saw the word vote in the car. Or I heard about voting on television. So there's
Dawn Burston Myers teaches music and movement at this tribal school, and she loves getting her students excited about democracy.
And that's what it's all about. Starting at that young age for them to grow up to be lifelong voters and maybe president or councilman in their community to help their community.
Every year, students exercise their right to choose between things like jump rope versus basketball, PE versus math. It's through a nonprofit Mrs. Myers works with called Kids Voting Arizona. Her kindergartners sprawl out across the floor to fill out their practice ballots. The kids are on edge as they await the real vote from the entire student body later on. Whichever menu item wins will be served to the whole school on November 6th. As the clock strikes 11 a.m., students roll into the library. It's decorated with art of pizzas, nuggets, and American flags.
I'm going to give you a ballot, okay?
I can't believe this is happening.
The students get their ballots and walk over to privacy booths made out of cardboard.
Then they drop their ballots in a box where Martin Javier places stickers on their shirts.
You know what that says? I voted today. Thank you.
Javier is the president of Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community. He knows just how hard it's been for Native Americans to exercise their right to vote. He reads out loud a banner in the schoolyard.
Your grandparents couldn't vote, but you can. And so that's kind of been the slogan here in the community.
Voter suppression tactics kept indigenous people in Arizona from voting until the 1970s. Javier and his team are working hard to get out the vote for next week's election, and these kids are a part of it.
Hopefully the kids are also going home and letting their parents know, hey, I voted today, and we would like you to go vote in not only our tribal elections, but the national elections, which is a very important election in Indian country.
It's a conversation sixth grader Alonzo Lopez has been having with his family.
I think it's really important because our ancestors weren't able to vote because the whites thought we weren't a part of them and that they were going to change us.
Once the ballots are in, tensions are high as the student council gathers to tally them.
41?
41.
And finally,
are we ready for the results of our election?
That's Principal Amanda Guerrero on the loudspeaker in the library.
The winner is Pizza!
Yay!
Yes, there were clearly cheers and some disappointment, but as the students of Salt River Elementary learned today, your candidate losing can be a part of the process.
Are you disappointed?
Chicken Nugget was gonna win.
Was it still fun to get to vote and share your voice, though?
Yeah.
And anyway, what kid doesn't want pizza for lunch? From Salt River Elementary, I'm Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
Today, there is a big celebration in Mexico City, the Feast of St. Jude. He's the unofficial saint of the city, and the celebration mixes the holy and the profane. That's because over the years, the Catholic saint for impossible causes has also become the people's saint. NPR's Eder Peralta reports.
The day before San Judas Tadeo's feast, tens of thousands of Mexicans parade through his church. Most people here have asked him for a miracle, and they promise him something small in return, that they would come sing him Las Mañanitas on his feast day, that they would give strangers a piece of candy, or give away prayer cards or candles, or teeny bouquets of gardenias. And on this day, you see everyone at this church. Moms with babies, kids dressed as St. Jude, groups of young people smoking marijuana just outside the church. Susana Lara Crisoforo was standing right outside with her daughter holding a statue of St. Jude. She became a devotee after her uncle was cured from cancer. That was many years ago. She remembers when she arrived at the church, a man gave her a statue.
Yo creo que de tanta fe que tenía, mire, un señor llegó y me lo dio en mis brazos.
I had so much faith, she said. The statue just landed in my arms. There are many beliefs around St. Jude. One is that in order for a prayer to be effective, someone has to gift you a statue. This year, Crisoforo gifted her daughter a statue. It's why she's here on the eve of this feast.
Porque con ella sí tuvo un problema muy, muy feo.
She doesn't elaborate, but she says her daughter had turned to something very ugly. But St. Jude brought her back to the family.
Mire, que me dieron ganas de llorar. Pero sí, con la fe de Dios.
Faith in God, she says, can move mountains. Miriam Cruz Mejia is an anthropologist who studied religion. She says this devotion to St. Jude took off after a massive earthquake destroyed Mexico City in 1985. As Mejia describes it, Mexicans needed miracles, and they needed them fast.
Este sería como una religión rápida, religión.
Mejia says the cult of St. Jude became a kind of fast food religion. It was accessible and non-judgmental. Over the years, he became the go-to saint for young people. Now, on YouTube, you find hip-hop songs about St. Jude. You find t-shirts that represent him in gold-encrusted urban garbs.
San Judas Tadeo es el que me hace el paro, dicen los jóvenes. Es el que está conmigo. Es mi banda.
In the words of young people, she says, St. Jude is my homie. He's the one who's with me, the one who spots me.
Y entonces el feligrés siempre dice, ah, no, pues es que San Judas Tadeo me salvó.
So the faithful say, St. Jude saved me from the cancer I had. He helped me stop drinking. He kept my wife from knowing I was cheating. These days, across the city, you find St. Jude in altars alongside the Holy Death, a folk saint representing death who is condemned by the Catholic Church. They are uber saints, she says, popular ideas that have been elevated to the altars, not by the church, but by the people. Back at the church, it feels like a big party. Fireworks explode in the sky. Street vendors sell St. Jude t-shirts, lucky bracelets, amulets. Father Jesus Garcia says he isn't surprised at the popularity of St. Jude.
San Juditas Tadeo, venga uno con la intención que venga.
The thing about St. Jude, he says, is that no matter what people's intentions are, he will always listen. Adrian Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Carla Itzkovich, whose gift in memory of Moises Itzkovich, founder of the Moises Itzkovich Foundation, helps provide public radio news and information to communities around the world. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
With the school year starting and summer winding down, it can be hard to adjust your routines. But when it comes to news, Morning Edition does the work for you. Listen weekdays from NPR News.
You can hear Morning Edition from 5 to 9 a.m. tomorrow here on your KPR stations.
Support for KPR comes from Kansas City PBS, taking an in-depth look at the issues with area newsmakers and journalists on Week in Review, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. More information at kansascitypbs.org.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3. KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio.
This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Cherry Street Youth in Chanute, an after-school program for kindergarten through fifth grade students, welcoming volunteers for special projects, reading to the children, or to share a talent or skill. Details on how to get involved at cherrystreet.org.
Stay with us. Up next, we have news headlines, followed by Stardate, then Destiny is your host for 2 hours of classical music. Tonight, the theme is Moody Monday. Big feature tonight, Tchaikovsky's Pathétique, premiering on this day in 1893. It's all followed at 9 o'clock by Jazz in the Night. We do have wind advisories going into effect tomorrow at 9 a.m. for the entire KPR listening area. Expect winds gusting up to 55 miles per hour in some places. The time is 7:01, and the news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. In the final full week of the 2024 presidential race, Democrat Kamala Harris is in Michigan, speaking at a semiconductor plant in Saginaw County. Harris said her administration would both reassess federal jobs requiring a college degree and make the U.S. even more preeminent in terms of technological innovation.
What you are doing here on the ground makes real that investing in American industries and investing in American workers can happen at the same time. There doesn't have to be a tension between the two. That doing this work will also be about understanding, look, we got to win the competition for the 21st century. We're not going to have China beat us in the competition for the 21st century.
The plant, Hemlock Semiconductor, recently received a $325 million federal grant for a new factory. Democrat Tim Walz is in Wisconsin today. Former President Trump is campaigning in Atlanta, fresh off the latest controversy surrounding his campaign. At a rally last night at Madison Square Garden, a comedian Tony Hinchcliffe referred to Puerto Rico as a floating island of garbage, sending shockwaves through that community. For his part, Trump used the opportunity to propose a tax credit for family members who take care of a parent or loved one. The state of Virginia is asking the Supreme Court to pause a ruling that orders the state to restore some 1,600 registered voters that were purged from the voter rolls. More from NPR's Hansi Luong.
This emergency request comes after a federal appeals panel called Virginia's arguments weak and, quote, not how courts interpret statutes. A judge ruled its voter removal program illegally purged registered voters from the state's rolls during the 90-day quiet period before a federal election when such programs are banned. An August executive order by Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin resulted in daily updates to voter rolls in order to remove people who are not able to verify they are U.S. citizens to Virginia's Department of Motor Vehicles. But the state could not show in court that any non-citizens were removed. Instead, U.S. citizens had their voter registration canceled. In Virginia, in-person registration for this election continues through Election Day. Hansi Luong, NPR News.
The UN says countries need bolder plans to avoid catastrophic impacts from climate change. More from NPR's Michael Copley.
Countries agreed to limit global warming to try to prevent more destructive storms, heat waves, and other extreme weather. Hitting the target requires big cuts in emissions from burning fossil fuels. But according to a new UN report, plans countries have put forward so far won't do nearly enough. To meet the global target, countries need to slash greenhouse gas emissions by 43% this decade compared to where they were in 2019. Under current plans, the UN says emissions this decade are expected to fall by less than 3%. The UN warns such a shortfall would lead to global warming that would be disastrous for people and economies around the world. A new round of UN climate talks starts in November. Michael Copley, NPR News.
The Dow was up 273 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. This is Kansas Public Radio.
Stardate, October 28th. There are many reasons you might feel tired, irritable, and headachey when you wake up in the morning. Illness, allergies, noisy neighbors. But you might also blame it on too much light, especially blue light. Looking at your phone or TV before bedtime can mess with your natural sleep cycle. Another source of trouble is outdoor lighting. Street lamps, billboards, car headlights, and other sources fill the night with light. That creates a dome of light over most cities and towns. A dome of sky glow. In fact, 99% of all Americans live beneath such a dome. The glow creates all kinds of problems. It prevents us from seeing the wonders of the universe. It can endanger wildlife, and many studies have shown that it can endanger our health as well. That's especially true with bluer light. Those wavelengths activate the receptors in the eye that we use most during the day. So they're telling your body that it's daytime, not night. Exposure to bright outdoor lighting can suppress the body's production of melatonin. That's a hormone that plays an important role in the immune system, the health of several major organs, and the body's natural rhythm. In particular, it can cause you to lose sleep or to have a poor night's sleep. Experts recommend reducing the amount of outdoor light pollution and making sure that street lamps have a warmer glow, helping everyone to get a good night's sleep. More tomorrow. For the University of Texas at Austin McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
Song of Thanks. Thanks Now to God by Johann Sebastian Bach, a chorale here on KPR by the Laban Brass Ensemble. I am your host, Destiny, and I wanted to extend my thanks to all of you, dear listeners, especially for coming out last Friday to support KPR's Live Day. It was really fun to meet so many of you, and what a treat. You all are just the best listeners, the best. I have something, speaking of the best, by Brahms for you coming up at around 7:55. The best of Brahms, shall I say. It's really quite nice. A lovely romance to end the evening together. Before we talk about what we are about to hear, guess what? I know Halloween is just around the corner, but it's never too soon to talk about Christmas. Saturday night, December 14th is KPR's Big Band Christmas, and the KC Jazz Orchestra will be on hand once again, providing some big band hits and Christmas faves. Tickets are on sale at the Liberty Hall box office and Ticketmaster. Thank you to Dr. Stephen H. Chronister, Healing Smiles of Topeka. A treat for my dear listeners, Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6, something that actually premiered on this day. It is one of his most famous. It's the Pathétique. I hope you enjoy it. Sit back and let's dive in. It's about 40 minutes long right now on KPR with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra.